and gals. Great to speak with you once again. I hope you're having a good day today. This is Red Eyes Radio. I'm Henrik Palmgren from Sweden, and the website is redeyescreations.com. Also take a look at redeyesradio.net to go straight to the radio archive. And of course, we have also redeyesmembers.com, our members website for subscribers and supporters, where you have the full archives and everything back to our start since 2006. Today we're talking with Lawrence Eastman. He's a longtime researcher, filmmaker, and anti-usury social justice campaigner. Lawrence is an activist for monetary reform and land reform through the abolition of usury, the creation of interest-free credit, and a contemporary system of what he calls tribal anarchy. His bio says that at the core of Lauren's work is a struggle against the cabal of private international bankers that have a monopoly over our money supply. He believes that if we are to experience any real sense of freedom, then we must find solutions to that monopoly, because banking is nothing more than institutionalized usury, which many would say is the root cause of nearly all problems. We are being controlled by those who control the money and have the capability of lending with interest and also make money from just having money. Well, Lawrence is with us today because he recently ended up in the headlines, particularly in Great Britain, because he was set to be part of the debate that was to launch Russell Brand's new book called Revolution. So Lawrence was part of a smear campaign, particularly by the left and the cultural Marxists, that also was set to be part of this debate, the people was part of Russell Brand's book. So Brand predictably folded to this pressure instead of having Lawrence on to debate him on these issues, if they're so morally superior. Just prove Lawrence wrong with facts, right? So that didn't occur. Lawrence has instead been called an anti-Semite because he addresses usury or interest. He's been called a Nazi because he doesn't buy the World War II propaganda story that we've been fed for 70 years. And furthermore, he's been called a racist because he's gotten smart to the ongoing population replacement agenda in Europe. In other words, he is a white person that has self-preservation instincts. Yep, that's right. So these are the predictable labels that the left has tried to throw at people like Lawrence, who they can't or won't debate, and of course seek a kind of a quick discrediting of their reputation. So today we're not here only to help clear up Lawrence's name, to actually hear from him himself, to let us know what he really thinks and what conclusions he has come to and what basis and foundation lies behind these conclusions. There actually is data and material and information here, of course, to go into. So we're going to get to, you know, Russell Brand and his fellow politically correct pro-establishment revolutionaries a little bit later in the program. We're going to begin to go through Lawrence's, well, timeline, if you will, because along the way of his own work and awakening lies an interesting journey, and also one of success against the bankers. And this is the very reason he was to go on the debate in the first place. He has merit in kicking some banker butt. So this is a very interesting story. Please stay with us. I think there's a lot to be learned along the way for this extended segment. Welcome to Red Eyes Radio, Lawrence Eastman. It's great to speak with you. Thank you so much for coming on. It's great to have you here.
Hi, Henrik. Thanks for having me.
Well, you bet. This is going to be a really good show, I think. And you have such a interesting and fascinating story, everything that's happened to you in the last few years. I know it's been a long journey for you. I've been going through your timeline, if you will, a little bit, and some of the things I think we actually share in common of how we've developed and opened our eyes to various things. But tell us just a little bit about yourself, about your journey onto this. There's a huge controversy here later in the timeline that we'll talk more about, of course, what happened and how you've been ousted over in the UK there. But what got you started on this journey, Lawrence?
I kind of always been a little bit, you know, rebellious. I'm from Liverpool, and Liverpool has got a really rebellious streak running through it. It's the Irish and the Celtic blood within us, you know. But I kind of always been against authority, and I was expelled from two schools, and I left when I was 15 with no qualifications. And then I kind of just stumbled onto various books and topics that just captivated me and sent me on my way. I read a book called Fingerprints of the Gods by Graham Hancock. I think it was in 1996 or 97 or something.
Yeah.
And that exposed me to this incredibly rich hidden history of the origins of man and secret history, that just captivated me, you know, and I was hooked. And from there, I just tried to devour as many books on secret societies and Knights Templar, Freemasons, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I was just fascinated by it, because my school or my education, none of those things were apparent. You know, it was very boring, very, you know, static. And I now realize that was part of a Prussian education system, but at the time I didn't. So it was kind of like I was back at school, but I was teaching myself and all these fascinating subjects. And ultimately, that led me to David Icke. You know, in 1997 and 98, I think I read The Biggest Secret. And The Biggest Secret is just so wild. It's just so out there, you know. And it had a kind of a life-changing effect upon me, in that once you've read that stuff, there's no going back, you know. And I went to watch him in Manchester to an audience of about 50 people. I mean, this was before Icke, you know, became a global phenomenon that he is today.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, and even though I only read David Icke's books in the beginning, he still is a powerful figure amongst the conspiracy truth movement, if you like. I mean, he doesn't go far enough in my view. But back then, you know, a lot of the things that he said were ridiculed, but have ultimately come to pass. You know, the satanic pedophiles, destruction of America, amongst many other things. And it was, by the time 9/11 happened in 2001, I was already aware that 9/11 was an inside job. As it was happening, I was watching it with my father, and we said, this is it, you know, this is them going for it, and we're going to see the world change. And not long after, I put a book out on 9/11, you know, which is pretty close to what a lot of people still talk about today.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was quite a lonely space back then, you know, talking about 9/11 and the anomalies and the unanswered questions and the things that quite obviously make it, you know, not what the official narrative is. I mean, you're ridiculed. You talk about that amongst even your friends, and you were ridiculed. So it was something of a private awareness, you know. You wouldn't speak to too many people about it, and it was a private affair. That kind of led me on to the Zionist conspiracy. You know, I didn't really know much about Zionism or Judaism or any of those things, and I read a book by Arthur Koestler called The 13th Tribe, in which he put forward the hypothesis that most of the Jews around today are from an area in the middle, the Caucasus Mountains, used to be called Khazaria, you know, and most of the Western Jews, the Ashkenazim Jews, are converts to Judaism, non-Hebrew, and that was just incredible. That just blew my mind, and I then followed the whole Zionist conspiracy thread, and, you know, that led me to the bankers, you know, and
that really set you off on a different path. All of this is very much connected, of course. One thing leads to another, as it always is. But I guess this is where you found some of your forte, if I can put it that way. Correct?
Yeah, totally. Because, you know, you just go down different paths, and you know, you kind of let it take you where it leads, and you've got no real idea where you're heading. There's no plan. It's just, you know, open up to the information and allow myself to be driven by it, you know. And it was the Zionist conspiracy that really opened my eyes at that stage, because all of a sudden I could start to see people behind these conspiracies, if you like, rather than shapeless forms or corporations or stuff like that. There's actual people now, you know. So that kind of led me to trying to understand money, you know. And the big breakthrough I had was around about 2007, I saw a film called The Money Masters by Bill Still. And that still remains a seminal film upon the whole idea of the money scam, you know. And I had no idea about money beforehand. I'd never even really considered it. I'd never thought about it in the sense of, what is it? Where does it come from? Who creates it? What's happening there, you know? But I presume that The government did. Presume that, you know, it was our money. And what I found out from the Money Masters is a private cabal of international bankers create money from nothing, which they then lend us at interest. And it was the discovery of interest, or as it's historically known as usury, that things really started to get interesting. Because now, not only could I put a face to the plan, but I could also see the mechanism, you know?
Yeah.
Usury is one of the most powerful forces on the planet. It is the key centralizer of wealth, and it enables the bankers to accumulate most of the property on the planet, be that land or businesses or any other form of property, is accumulated into the hands of a very small amount of people, and they do this through usury. You know, the whole banking scandal of 2008 is just a modern version of a very ancient pattern. You know, the banks use usury to create abundance of credit. They inflate the currency, and then they get the population into debt based upon this easy, accessible credit. And once enough people are in debt, then they flick the switch to a deflationary period, and they start to withdraw the money from circulation, making it scarce. And once money's scarce, people start to default on loans, and the property they pledged to the credit in the first place is suddenly now transferred into the hands of the bankers. And it's a very simple scam. They repeat the same method throughout the last 350 years at least, but probably a lot longer. And this is how they're able to transfer the wealth of the poor into the hands of the rich. And by the rich, I mean the opulent plutocracy at the top.
Yeah, not middle-class, hard-working people. Some include as the rich, you're right.
Well, that's what Marx wants us to think, isn't
it? Yeah,
Marx,
exactly.
Tries to think the rich are the middle class, or the poor fight against the middle class. Meanwhile, they leave the elite at the top, you know, free and clear.
Yeah.
And it's this hidden mechanism, it's this hidden idea behind banking that is really, you know, the root cause of most of our social problems. And it's really well hidden. And, you know, there are many, many layers of distraction and obfuscation in front of this usury issue, this banking issue, that it's quite difficult to navigate through to the center of it. And when you do, you have to pass many guardians, many screaming banshees, guard way right through to the heart of the issue, you know?
Yeah.
So that was a real intense period. I was studying money, studying banking, working out who was behind the scam. And in about 2009, that led me to another discovery, you know, which was, it's called the Common Law Movement here. It's also known as the Free Man on the Land. It's also called Lawful Rebellion. And it was a growing awareness in Britain, but it came from America, actually. America first developed it with the Free Men of Montana in the 90s. This growing awareness of the common law is there to protect us, you know, protect us from harm. And statutory law, which is law made by government, is only given the force of law by consent of the governed. Yeah, so basically we must consent to these laws that are being imposed on us by this out-of-control state. And it's a challenge. It's a challenge to the heart of the statist idea. And it's about becoming aware of our inherent rights and being able to enforce them and fight for them, you know. And there's a big kind of awakening, I'd say, in the common law countries of the West, that, you know, our rights are being trampled over, and actually we are quite powerful as individuals when we become aware of who we are, you know, our personal sovereignty, our personal power, and that we can actually do immense damage to their system as individuals, you know?
Yeah.
Because they operate on a presumption of authority. I call it the illusion of authority, and this is why they have to wear big hats. This is why they have to wear intimidating costumes, because they know they have to find a way to get you to comply, because they do not have the authority to impose these tyrannical measures on you, because what that does is that exposes their system as being a tyranny. And once a tyranny is exposed, then people rise up and destroy it, you know? So they have to give this illusion of authority, and they do so by keeping us ignorant, they do so by hiding the law, they do so through means of intimidation, you know, but it's a different world now, you know. It's, for the first time in human history, the entire catalogue of human achievement, you know, and law and progress is archived on the internet, and it's available to everybody.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Because they've had it, you know, knowledge as a monopoly for such a long, long time. That now, you know, they're facing a new challenge. Is what are they going to do with all the people that are away? Because the Goyim, you know, are no more. Well, that's what we hope. And so this was kind of like a spiritual awakening through the Lord, if that makes sense. It was
sure,
this awareness of who we are and the power we have. And I didn't realize at the time, and I don't think a lot in the movement realized, but it's a form of anarchy in the true sense of the word, in that, you know, it's no rulers, you are your own ruler, you are your own government, you know, and that was a real driving force. So, you know, I understood there was this deep and dark conspiracy of human history and human origins. I discovered the Zionist conspiracy, then I found out about the banking conspiracy, and then, you know, I kind of added the law aspect to it and this awakening of our personal sovereignty. And then I found out, you know, that my mortgage was also fraudulent. So it was a heavy mix. It was a heavy mix. And by this time, I'm feeling quite liberated and quite powerful. And maybe foolishly, or recklessly even, I decided to challenge my own mortgage.
Right, yeah.
I now knew that the money was created from thin air. There was, you know, this unlawful interest applied to it. And we started to discover that there is no contract, that no bank will sign a mortgage contract anywhere in the Western world. No banker will go on oath and say they lent us any money anywhere in the Western world. Any kind of contract that did exist was sold immediately upon completion to offshore entities. And it's a huge scam, you know. It's a huge, huge, mega scam, the mortgage fraud.
Yeah.
And it's key and central to their system of enslavement because, you know, mortgage also means death grip, yeah, in that they have you in their grip until you die, because mortgage is 25, 30 years. And
people can think about the Spanish word, I think it's Spanish, muerte, right? Muerte, meaning death. So mortgage and muerte, it's related, right? So it's a death of debt, I thought it meant. But yeah, you're right, death of grip, yeah.
It also can mean a death pledge. A literal translation from French is death pledge.
There you go.
So, you know, there's no messing there. And what you find out is that the mortgage is a relatively new addition to Britain. It was first introduced by William the Conqueror in 1066. He brought the Jews of Rouen with him from a part of France. And they brought commercial law with them called the Chetar. And it had never been seen on these islands before. You couldn't use the land to use as security for a loan. It simply wasn't allowed. You were only allowed to use movable items, you know, chattels, they're called. And William, with the Jews, brought this shetar, which was commercial law. And it was originally called the Jewish gauge, then it changed to mortgage, and it introduced this whole new law system to the British Isles. And usury was introduced. And William, with his feudal system, the feudal system being landlord-tenant, didn't exist before William the Conqueror. Before that, Britain, or Albion, as it was also known, operated on a allodial system. An allodial system is that if you own the land, you own it in totality. You have no lord above you. You are merely a custodian of the land until the next generation comes to use it, you know?
Yeah.
And this was the history of Britain was built on these ideas, which is also a form of anarchy, you know? So when William came, they brought the opposite. They brought monarchy, they brought usury, they brought the feudal system, and they brought the landlord-tenant idea, you know, and the people who were here before William, who had managed the land for generations, were suddenly, after the 1066 conquest, were suddenly tenants on their own land. And the feudal system itself is usury, because usury is also known as unearned income. Yeah, it's immoral, it's unethical. Every major religion on the planet has condemned it, you know, and a landlord earns from the labor of the tenant, and the landlord has done nothing for it other than to impose his will upon the land. So this was introduced to Britain in 1066, and then the mortgage kind of developed throughout that period, but was still heavily protected under the common law, which existed before William came. And they still have to do a shuffle and a hustle to get you off the land, you know? So we kind of knew this historical background, we knew the financial scam, you know, and I was kind of ready to challenge it. And I did, you know, I held back payments on principle.
Mm-hmm.
I said to the mortgage company, I said, you know, produce a contract. Until you can produce a contract, I don't believe one exists. And until then, I will withhold payments, you know. And you'd think, wouldn't you? You'd think that a bank who had lent you a serious amount of money would be able to produce a contract. You'd think that would be such a simple request. And that's the thing you see. When you start asking questions that have never been asked them before, and you don't get an answer. You don't get an answer to what really should be quite simple. And then the alarm bells start ringing and you become more convinced that you're right and you're on the right path. So there was no contract forthcoming. And then the bank applied for an eviction. You know, and I was convinced and quite stubborn and decided to see it through, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I made some applications into the court to try and get the eviction stopped. Based upon the principle, you know, I said to the judges, produce a contract. Produce a signed contract, you know. Because the bank don't sign any mortgage contract anywhere in the West.
Just a quick question about that. I know we don't want to get stuck too much on this. This is a fascinating story, of course, but you've done a lot of work on this in the past. But obviously, when you got the mortgage, you signed it, right? But it meant there was no one on the other side of that contract that signed anything. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, and a contract to be valid means the signature from both parties.
Both parties, of course, yeah.
So I made an application into the court to have the eviction stopped. The eviction was on September the 8th, 2011. I made an application into the court on the 6th of September, so 2 days before the scheduled eviction. And previous to that, I was calling all the courts, all the authorities in Liverpool, and I was, you know, expressing the common law, the Magna Carta, and I was saying, I want the king's peace, I want the king's peace. Because ultimately, the sovereign is only given their authority if they are able to maintain peace in the kingdom, yeah? And I was saying that, you know, I'm facing a violent attack here. I want protection from the sovereign or the people who are acting on behalf of the sovereign, be they the court, the judges, the police. And I was causing quite a stir in Liverpool. So on the 6th of September, 2 days before the eviction, I attended court, and there was about 20 police at the court. And it was quite an intimidating atmosphere. I've never been to court before. It was a new experience, you know. And, you know, heading into the courtroom, I was flanked by a tunnel of policemen. An actual tunnel of policemen flanking me into this courtroom. And, you know, at the time, my legal knowledge was very limited, you know, very limited. And I expressed my argument to the judge then the best way I could. Just demanded simple things, you know, please produce contract, please produce source of the money, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And the judge wasn't interested. He ruled against me. The next day, I had an appeal. That went against me. And then that was it. I was ready for the eviction. So the eviction was on the 8th of September 2011. And, you know, I kind of prepared for it. I'd sealed the house up. You know, I knew my rights. I knew they couldn't force entry because ultimately it's only a civil debt. It's only money, you know. It's only money. It was only for a very small amount, but it was a matter of principle for me. And I wanted to test. I wanted to test my knowledge or you know, my personal power, as it were.
Well, see, most people wouldn't do that. So it's good. You got some balls to do that, to try that out and see. And
yeah,
so what happened? What happened?
In hindsight.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
In hindsight, I may have done something different, you know. But in that moment in time, I was determined. I knew it was right.
Yeah.
I wanted to see how far they were prepared to go to expose the tyranny, show that they, you know, didn't respect the law, and they were quite prepared to cheat, to try and steal my property, you know.
Well, see, that's just the thing. I think a lot of people miss that thing, actually, in the you know, lawful rebellion and free men on the land movement, that, yeah, sure, you might be able to stick into the rules, but they don't do anyway, so what does it matter, right? They just come in and take it from you if they want it, you know?
No, but in some ways that's correct, but in others it's kind of like, well, you know, when you expose the tyranny, their power is diminished.
Mm-hmm.
Because they can't maintain a tyranny, you know? They can't maintain a tyranny for long, they have to hide it. It has to be, you know, this idea of British democracy being the home of democracy on the planet. That's crap.
Yeah.
That's all crap,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But the national identity is built around these myths. And if these myths are challenged or even exposed, then it does have a damaging effect upon the authority of the state. So even though we may lose the battle, the wider war is still raging, and we're still doing serious damage to the perceptions that they give to people, you know. So in the eviction, the bailiff arrives, then the police arrive. Now, the police, you've got to understand, are there to prevent a breach of the peace. The police are not meant to get involved in a civil matter over money. It's got nothing to do with them. Police deal with criminal issues. Bailiffs deal with civil matters, yeah. So the police turn up, and, you know, I tell them to leave my property, I tell them to get rid of the people on my property, and there's a bit of drama and stuff, you know, and then there was a lull, and then the next thing, the police call for backup, and then about 30 police arrive at my house, and without any word or warning or warrant, they bash their way into my house through the door. They smashed it off the hinges with a battering ram, flooded my living room. I was completely surrounded by the police, and they were demanding I leave. I said, what are you doing in my house? Why are you here? What authority do you have? What papers do you have? And they just couldn't produce anything, couldn't answer any questions. And after, you know, a couple of minutes confronting the sergeant turned around to the bailiff and said, what are we going to do?
Really?
I don't think they faced this before, you know. So the bailiff and the sergeant left the room. They conspired together. And then a couple of minutes later, the bailiff run in, threw me to the floor. As I tried to get back to my feet, I was jumped on, pounced on by police. And then I was arrested, put in handcuffs, led out of my property, placed in a little cage in the back of a van, taken to a police station, locked up for 6-7 hours, and then released without charge. And that's the thing, you see. Release without charge is important. So all that the police were doing were, in effect, they were acting as the enforcement arm of the banks.
Yeah.
They were a private entity. And they would just get me out of the way so that they could board the house up, you know. And they thought that was it. But, you know, I was prepared for the long game, and we re-entered the property the same night. And then that began a two-year struggle in and out the courts. I got evicted another three times, kept re-entering, and they just couldn't work out what to do because I knew that the property's mine. We have something called land registry here where you register real property, you know, landed property. And while my name is on that register, it remains my property throughout. So, you know, this turned into a two-year struggle, and they just couldn't get rid of me, you know. And I was fighting in all different courts, right up to the Court of Appeal. And, you know, it was difficult because I couldn't get legal representation. No lawyer really wanted to touch me, you know. And I was having to try and learn the law, express it the best I could, and just fight, you know, to save my property and make it difficult for them, you know, just put up some resistance, you know, put up some resistance. And I'm quite determined and I'm quite stubborn, and I don't think they realized how stubborn I am, you know, in this circumstance. And that kind of just developed. And because of my success in maintaining possession of my property and the experience it was getting in court, other people started to ask me if I could do the same for them.
Sure, yeah. Well, because this is one of the tricks here, right, that they do when they evict some people for the first time. People stay away from their own house. They don't do what you did. They don't return. They don't fight on that level. And, of course, when you consent to that, when you give it up, in effect, then they say, thank you very much, that's it. But I'm surprised they didn't change any of the paperwork, even the land registry. Let's say they go in instead of your name, they say, no, this is now the bank's name because, you know, you didn't make payment and whatnot. But you say they didn't do any of that.
They never do that. The property remains yours up until the property is sold. The bank can only ever have something called vacant possession. They are never the owners of the property. All they have is the right of sale. That's it. Right? So this is a real big scam, right? This eviction process, the possession process, it's hidden in decades, if not centuries, of corruption and corner cutting as well. So the property remains mine until such time as my name is no longer on the registry, the land registry. And that's the same for anybody. That's the same for anybody in UK at least. I'm not sure of the law in other places, but in UK at least, anybody who has been evicted from their property, you know, can re-enter any time because it's their property. And that's why they board it up. They don't board it up to keep squatters out. They board it up to keep you out.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
Now, the thing is 95% of evictions, the people have already gone. The bailiff turns up, the house is empty, and that's it. They just take vacant possession. Now, in a small number of cases, there may be some resistance in that 5%, but 95% of that 5%, once evicted, never go back. Right? There is only a very, very tiny, tiny percentage of people who re-enter the property once they've been evicted. Mm-hmm. And that's new territory, not only for the people doing it, but also for the court and the banks and the bailiff, because they don't know how to deal with it either, you know? And what we're doing is we're forcing errors from them, because they have to comply with the law. They have to comply with the common law and our rights and all those things, even though they don't and they ride roughshod over them. What you're doing is you're forcing an error, giving you a grounding to, you know, bring actions against them and just keep the fight going, you know? Keep the fight going. It depends whether, you know, it's something you want to commit to or something that you're interested in. But
so you can always kind of, almost in whatever area it is, you can always try to kind of demand the aspect of, you know, produce documents, show me where the contract between, you know, me and you, whoever you represent, actually is, and push them on these issues where they need to prove and produce stuff that indicates that how they're acting is the legal way. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's a maxim of law is he who makes the claim must prove the claim.
Yeah.
If they're claiming they have a contract, where is it? Let's see it, you know? They don't do it. They don't produce a valid contract. They'll produce some paperwork, but it's not a valid contract, you know? And also then you have the money creation. There is no loan. The bank didn't loan you anything. The money was created when you requested it, you know? It's not like the bank suffered a loss. It was when you put in your mortgage application, the bank put some numbers into a computer, created the money from thin air, which they then lend you at exorbitant rates of interest. And that's the scam, you know?
And then they make money on top of that with fractional reserve lending, etc. They can actually lend out in what is it, 10? No, it's actually more than that, way more than that. They can lend out much more than what you've lent. It's like a, you know, kind of, it just spirals out of control, really, in terms of what they can do with the money that was initially created just through one loan alone, right?
Yeah. It's just incredible. It's incredible how, you know, they get away with it. It's just incredible. And you know, if, you know, our currency should be created by our government, our people, our communities. It should not be created by some private international banks, you know, who don't have any particular skill. They don't have any particular asset. They just push some buttons. They push some buttons. We should be pushing buttons. You know, it should be the preserve of the sovereign people. How can a people be sovereign if we don't create our own money? We can't, because that means we are indebted to the forces that create our currency. It's absolutely key and central. And then, you know, you find out all the banks are all offshore anyway. You know, they're not even on UK. It's just a gigantic scam, and it's designed to disrupt people's lives. It's designed to transfer the wealth from the poor to the rich, and it's also part of the genocide, you know, destroying people's communities, destroying people's lives.
Yeah.
It's an active part of the genocide of you know, the European people that we're seeing at the moment.
That's right. Yeah.
It's central. It really is central.
Tell us a little bit about the bird family there.
Okay. So as a result of my success, I suppose, as a result of my resistance is probably better. Friends of mine, the bird family, were also facing an eviction and asked if I could help. I agreed and headed, I can't remember where it was, Barnet. Yeah, it was in Barnet, I think. I can't remember. But I went down to help them with an eviction. And, you know, by this point, I'd experienced 4 evictions. I was quite seasoned, as it were, you know, and we learned a lot from each one. We learned what the police were prepared to do, what the bailiffs were doing, what the bank was doing, what the agent was doing, you know, and each time we tried to apply our knowledge to take control of the situation better, you know. So with this eviction, the plan was to call the police before the bailiff, you know. So we're on record as being the victim. And, you know, that day, we couldn't have asked for better bailiffs in the sense that they were like pantomime villains, you know. They were the archetypal stereotype of what you think a bailiff is, you know. They're comic characters. They were perfect. And then, you know, we had the perfect police because we were in the kind of a nice part of the country. It was countryside. And the police weren't as exposed to the city, you know, violence, if you like. Whereas the police who evicted me, they're called Matrix Division, and they're like a heavy-duty police, you know. So there were many factors in our favor on that day. And then, you know, the day unfolded. And the video was about 28 minutes, but it was actually about 2.5 hours, 3 hours. And
People versus the banks. It's still up on YouTube, obviously. People want to take a look at that who haven't.
Conviction beats eviction. That's the subtitle.
Yep.
And, you know, we just decided to stand our ground and, you know, put the law to the bailiff. And there's, you know, various documents that are hidden from the homeowner, you know, and they're hidden by the warrant is folded in two. so that there's documents inside that they hide. There's just so many little scams that they're trying to pull, you know, that they're preying on people's ignorance and expecting people not even to be there when they arrive. So, you know, the bailiff is being obnoxious and arrogant and, you know, everything you imagine of a tyrannical state is expressed in this bailiff, you know, like something from the Middle Ages he was, you know. And the police arrived, we dealt with the police well, and then what you don't see much on the video is that the sergeant, he was on the phone to the court and lawyers for about an hour, and they were telling him what the procedure is, the true procedure. And fortunately, one of the people who were helping me on it, they came over to tell me and said, the lawyers have told them that they're not allowed to use force, that they've got to ask me to leave the property. If I refuse to leave the property, then that's called a verbal resistance, and then they have to stand back, right?
Hmm.
So that's exactly what happened. Bailiff asked me for the keys, I say no, and then he tries to jump over the fence, and I tell the police, you know, he's trespassing, and the police turned around. The police said to me, is that verbal resistance? I said, yeah. He then says to the bailiff, that's verbal resistance, I advise you to walk away. Now, that's what should happen at evictions if you decide you don't want to go. That's how you have a peaceful resolution to the situation. Now, the bank, if they want to, you know, continue the process, they can go back to court and they can get a different type of warrant, an arrest warrant for contempt of court. Yeah, so that's, you know, what they should do. And then, you know, it ended. We were victorious on that day. It was a great day. And the reason we cheered the police is because we'd faced so many violent evictions, you know, and this was the first time the police had acted in the scope of their office, which was to prevent a breach of the peace. And it was the bailiff was the one that was threatening the breach of peace. And they stopped him, you know, it was great. Unfortunately, about 6 weeks later, the bailiffs came back to the same property which we attended, and this time the police had been told off. The police had been told off. The sergeant, unfortunately, had been reprimanded, and he wasn't on the scene. But all the other police, the same police, were there. And this time, the bailiff brought the heavies. He brought high court enforcement officers, and it was literally, they charged us. They smashed their way through, and then just, you know, were acted in a very violent manner, and there was an aggressive scene. Bailiffs were pushing us and stuff like that, and we were turning around to the police and saying, this is an assault. And the police were saying, no, we don't see any assault, and basically turned the other direction. They got possession of the property that time, and then the Bird family continued to struggle, you know, to maintain possession of the property for another year. I think he re-entered about four times. I think he was evicted six times in all in the end. You know, he just kept re-entering. But in the end, you know, he had a young family and, you know, life takes over and the bank were able to sell it. But not after them putting up a, you know, fierce and valiant resistance to the banks, which pisses them off, you know.
So the only reason potentially why they managed to sell it is because there was no one actually still in the house at that time. So let's say the Bird family just kept going in and just kept doing that, they might have still, well, I mean, exactly what you said, you face that prospect of not having peace in your own house, of course, and you constantly have to fight with the police that shows up at your door, correct?
Yeah, it's a very stressful period. It's a very, very, very stressful period when you're challenging this, because people want to attack you and steal your home. You know, that's what you're up against. It's outright piracy on the high seas. And it's war, you know, and you don't know what's coming next. You don't know when they're going to turn up. It's a very, very stressful period. And you can only really do it for so long until you either get victory or the bank sell the property. But even if the bank sell the property, it's still a victory of sorts, you know, because what you've discovered about yourself is as important as what you've discovered about the bank. You know, I think that's a real benefit of the whole struggle, you know.
What happened to your house here then? We didn't finish that.
Okay, so I continued, you know, fighting them and just ducking, dodging, bobbing and weaving. And they tried to sell it three times, and each time I managed to block them. You know, I did various tricks and moves and just blocked them. But in the end, they managed to get it on the market in an auction. And it was at a time where, you know, synchronicity and the gods were with me. The great god of Wotan was with me, you know. And my friend who I was working with at the time, Neil Heffey, he was a property, he worked in property, you know. And the bank, because they couldn't sell it, because every time it went up for auction, people who were interested in buying it would have to do some checks. And what they found was that I come with the property. So you're buying it, I'm still there, you know. You got your work cut out to get rid of me, you know. So the price was plummeting. It just kept plummeting because they couldn't sell it. And then eventually they were able to get it in auction and there was no bids. There was absolutely no bids. And it was at a rock bottom price, you know, a massive bargain. And it failed in auction. And then the bank put it on the market and said, we're open to offers. So I just said to my friend, do you fancy putting a bid in, a cheeky bid? And he did. He put in a very, very low bid. And they bit his hand off, you know, they bit his hand off. And it was one point where I'm on a computer in the office and I'm emailing the bank telling them about the fraud that they're doing and I'm going after them and I'm going to sue them. And literally a few seconds later, they'd ring up my friend and say, have you paid yet? Have you paid? Have you paid? They didn't know what was going on. I mean, we were laughing, you know. And, he was successful. He was able to buy the property and I'm back in. I'm back in the property and I'm no threat of eviction and just in the process of transferring the title back to me. You know.
So let's just think about that for a moment then, because then we have, we don't have to talk about the actual numbers here if you don't want to, but nonetheless, you took out a mortgage to buy the house, right? And then you're paying on that for a while, then you're realizing you can do this. You're trying that out. I don't know what happens during this time in terms of money, if they're trying to, you know, if they fine you or whatever happens, we can detail that later. But what I'm getting at here is that eventually your friend makes a bid. The price has been dumped significantly, meaning that the mortgage you initially paid, the value for you in that sense has gone way up if you manage to get it back for less, correct?
Correct.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, but it's not really about that for me. You know?
No, of course not. I'm just seeing how in terms of how they create money out of thin air in the similar way you now manage to create a value of a house, not out of thin air, through hard work and your sweat equity of keeping up with the stress of the stuff, of course, but nonetheless, right, monetarily wise, it's a gain for you.
Yeah, of course. You have to treat it as a gain. You have to treat it as a gain because otherwise it's too emotionally draining for you, you know. At the very beginning of the struggle, I was completely emotionally attached to the whole thing and it was very stressful. And, you know, it affected my health. It affected my health for periods, you know.
Yeah.
Then I was able to take some distance and realize that this is a game. You know, this is a game. The other side aren't emotionally attached. Why should I be, you know? And then when you get to that point, you're able to see clear. You're able to see more clearly. And you can make better decisions. And, you know, you become more open to opportunity. And that's ultimately what happened. It was about holding my position as long as I could until an opportunity presented itself, which it did, and I grasped it, and I was successful with that. Now, that's given me some respite, if you like, some respite while I plan my next move against the bank, because this isn't over. This isn't over by any stretch of the imagination, because basically what's happening is that in America, the same argument that I've been presenting to the courts here has been successful in America. And a couple of years ago, the American courts ordered that the bank put aside $30 billion to compensate 400,000 people who had been unlawfully evicted in circumstances very similar to mine, in securitization of mortgages, no contract, violence being used. And the courts have ordered the banks to pay up, and they believe this is just the beginning. You know, this isn't just a one-off payment. This is the that the floodgates may open against the banks in relation to, you know, what happened during that whole derivative scam that was engineered at the highest levels of the banking cabal, you know, to help manipulate their global agenda. But, you know, in America, that breakthrough has already been achieved by, you know, vigilant citizens who have kept pressing until the sheer weight of pressure upon the courts has forced them to give. Now, you know, UK is a different prospect. It's a small island. The city of London is the home of the banking scam. You know, the legal profession is also centred in the city of London, and in my view, the lawyers act merely as gatekeepers to protect the banks, you know, from criminal convictions or even civil wins. So here it's a stronghold, and I think it will take more resistance, it will take more pressure from us before we achieve a breakthrough similar to what's happened in America. But I do believe it will happen. And, you know, I will continue the struggle against the banks in this sense, and long may it continue. But for now, that's for me, that particular fight's over for now, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's a win in your view, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I'd say so, yeah. It was an incredible adventure, learned a lot, you know, and I've still got my home.
Well, that's awesome, you know. And, of course, your success here in this area has set you off into a few different paths. You know, we're going to get to a little bit later here what more recently has been going on to the UK, your connection with Russell Brand and some of the debates and all that. We'll get to that, folks, here a little bit down the road. But let's just go on a little bit of a sidetrack, because I think this is an interesting one. It's pertinent to my own, you know, path as well and whatnot. But you really got into some of the other material here, for example, like Dennis Wise film and, you know, some of this other material that put things in perspective for us. I think it's always interesting to hear how people stumble upon this and kind of reawaken, if you will, to some of the things that what they thought and believed about our history and our world. So just tell us a little bit about that.
So I made the film The People versus the Banks, and that became a viral YouTube video. It just went crazy. I mean, it just went absolutely crazy. I didn't release it for another year after I first made it. And, you know, it's been seen about 1.5 million times. It's been seen in 150 countries, and the feedback was just amazing. It was just amazing. And that kind of led me to set up a group in Liverpool called Albion. Because my experience of going through the courts and everything made me realize that there is no real remedy for us in these courts. There is no real remedy against the state, because the state is nothing more than a criminal enterprise to, you know, maintain their domination over territory, to protect the ruling class, and to, you know, expand their dominion, you know. And I don't believe that they're going to be giving me much remedy. So it was on that idea I decided to set up a group called Albion, based upon the principles of Britain before, you know, William came, based on anarchist ideas and of self-determination, self-governance, and just kind of breaking free from the corporate vehicle that is United Kingdom. Set up a group in Liverpool, and it was a really good period. A lot of people coming together from all over the country, and we're all sharing the same ideas, and it was vital, it was vibrant, and it was quite exciting. And then, you know, another one of those moments occurred in the narrative where you're just thrown completely and sent on a completely different direction. A friend of mine on Facebook, Jan Irvin, he posted a video on his Facebook, and I could see he was getting a lot of abuse for posting it, you know. And it was called Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told. And I saw it, and I was intrigued, but I wasn't really ready to watch it, you know. And up to this point, you know, I've done a lot of research in the whole conspiracy truth thing, you know. One thing that comes up very early is that Hitler was a Rothschild and he worked for the bankers.
Right. Yeah.
Now, That's a genius piece of misinformation, right? Because the effect that that has is to keep people away from deep study into the other side of the story in the Second World War. And that's the effect it had over me. I just, you know, thought he was just another shill and decided to go no further with the research, you know. And I knew all about the Bolshevik revolution murdering, you know, 50 million white Christians. And I knew all about all the other genocides committed by Bolsheviks and communism. But I was just, Second World War was a taboo. It was a area you don't step, you know, and if you do, you're going to face the screaming banshees, you know. So I was reluctant to watch the video on that basis. And then I kind of built up the courage and I watched it, you know, and I was compelled. I was overcome with emotion. You know, I watched the entire 6 hours in two nights and it just blew me away, you know. The other side of the story from the German perspective, which I'd never heard before, never seen, and never even considered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the issues that were raised in that film were just so shocking, and they were right to the core of my being, you know. It had a profound effect over me, and it kind of changed me, if you like, you know. I realized that I'd broken through a taboo, massive, massive taboo, and a huge gate that is protected by the forces of, you know, the Dark Lord. And I was able to get through, and the things I learned from that film, you know, that some of the facts, you know, Danzig, Hitler trying to negotiate the peace, the economic miracle, you know, which came out because the Germans kicked the bankers out and created interest-free credit, you know, and created an incredible revolution in Germany that saw 6 million people in work within 2 years, and just incredible facts that were hidden. Judea declaring war upon Germany in 1933, you know, a lot of people got unaware of that fact. You know, then the Havana Agreement, which was the transfer agreement, which was voluntary and was happening right up until the war began. You know, the Balfour Declaration. And then, you know, the war itself, which was horrible, you know, a horrible period for everyone involved.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. A massacre of European peoples, you know.
It's a fratricide or something, isn't it? You know,
decimation
of the best of our people.
Yep.
You know, 50 million. You know, include if you add the Russian genocide as well. You know, the European stock took a heavy hit.
Hundreds of million. We've never seen a genocide like it in the history of the world, and it wasn't brought on by our own. Doing. This was manipulation behind the scenes.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you read the protocols, it was well planned. It was well planned. They wanted to destroy Germany and Russia, you know, and they achieved that to a large degree, you know, and it was just amazing just to see another side of the story, you know.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
What was most profound and what was most disturbing was what happened after the war. I had no idea about the 2 million rapes of German women from 8 to 80. I had no idea about the death camps created by Eisenhower, in which, you know, 1 to 2 million just normal German men were starved to death in a field just surrounded by barbed wire. And then to discover what they did in Dresden and other German towns and cities, which they firebombed the working class. You know, it was horrific. I mean, just the most barbaric of genocides I've ever looked at. And it really upset me, you know, it really did upset me at the time.
Yeah.
I felt a deep sense of guilt. I felt a deep sense of guilt that I've condemned the German people my entire life, you know. No, I'm not even talking about the National Socialists. I'm talking about just the average German people, you know, who were the ultimate victims of that war, you know. It kind of threw me kind of through my whole thing, I was concentrated completely in a different area until I watched that film, and then saw the film, boom, you know, it just catapulted me into a completely separate world, massive breakthrough. All of a sudden, I can see the story from the other side. Huge pieces of the jigsaw fell into place, you know. And then, you know, the aftermath, you know, the communists won the war. The communists won the war.
Yeah.
And their goal is the destruction of Western civilization, the dispossession, and the genocide of the European people from their ancestral homes, from their ancestral land. I mean, that's now clear to me is what the goal is, and what they, you know, quite advanced in achieving that goal.
Oh yeah, yeah. We have to wake up to this quickly, very very quickly, because it is damn close, and we're teetering right on the edge here, teetering right on the edge, I guess. And what's interesting about this too, I think, is to see the level of demonization of the German miracle of associating with a Hollywood image of what Nazism is as opposed to the real image of what it really is. We've talked about that now on quite a few shows here. But the very aspect that one nation tried to do something which was counterintuitive to the globalist banking system, of it's kind of a key portion in trying to cracking that nut, you know, and saying, all right, there's other ways of doing this, and consequently, what happens when that occurs? What happens when true ingenuity of human potential breaks away from the slavery of the economic system? I mean, that what was depicted in that film, and of course in a lot of the other research that that the film is based upon, fits very much into the kind of work that you've been doing in terms of solution. Like, how do we? Why is the banking system the way it is? What's it intended to do in terms of enslaving, you know, the people in the West primarily, but of course it's a global thing, we know that too. But at the same time then, showing a different alternative and offering an image of what a country can do to break out of that. It's right in line with what you've been working on, really, correct?
Absolutely, and that's interesting is that, you know, in my case, I discovered the money scam, challenged this alleged debt, and faced the wrath, you know, of the bankers to some degree. Now, if you look at the German situation, is that Germany was destroyed after the First World War, plunged into incredible debt. Certain Germans were aware of this and said, hold on a minute, this debt doesn't exist. Challenged the debt and kicked out the bankers and said, no, you're not taking our land, you're not taking our property, you're not taking our country, and we're going to fight for it. You know, and ultimately they faced the wrath of the bankers again. You know, it was a similar parallel, maybe not as epic as the German struggle, but it's about the recognition of usury at the core of the issue.
Yeah.
And the levels the banks are prepared to go to maintain that monopoly and also to hide the real mechanism. And what they've done with the Germans is to completely smear their character. They've spent billions of pounds since over the last 70 years to smear, defame, slander, and destroy the reputation of the Germans to the point where the German people, you know, they're so passive in relation to what happened. Then again, they're, you know, controlled by very harsh laws. But, you know, and that's why they've demonized it, because they don't want people getting the same idea, which is that we can't break away from the banks. We can't create our own money interest-free. And when we do, we create economic miracles wherever we try it, because Germany is not the only place to do this, you know?
No.
Germany is one country that was part of a global struggle against the bankers. You know, that kind of, it kind of spread over the most of the Western world, and it was the Germans who had the most visible success. You know, the Italians did the same, the Japanese in Australia and New Zealand. They also created something called social credit, which was credit available to everybody besides the banks. It happened in Canada. In Britain, there was a movement to establish social credit. I mean, this was a global awakening and counter-revolution by the people against the banks, against usury. And the banks had to drop two nuclear weapons to crush it, you know?
Yeah.
But the truth will out. The truth will out, and now I don't think they're prepared for this. The next wave of a tsunami of awareness is fast approaching them.
It is.
Whether they can stem that tide this time, you know, is going to be interesting to see.
Well, you know, ironically here, as you mentioned before, the banking system has worked very deep, close in line with the Marxists as their willing dupes here, and really as a world system developed as a way to crush the resistance of those that are trying to break out. And again, I've appealed to this number of times, but don't fall in line with conjuring up the Hollywood version of what you believe that the National Socialists were about. You know, it's just, that doesn't work. You have to look at it from a different perspective and realizing that it's an ideological battle. It's a war in terms of, you know, control of the world. And we had other guests on the program talking about this too. And just giving people this conception and this idea that the responses as well of the National Socialists were perfectly understandable and valid aspects in terms of responding to the threat that they were faced with at the time. And then there, of course, is just an avalanche of mis and disinformation surrounding this that people immediately go to. But if we just look at the issue at hand in terms of the economic system and just trying to break out and do something different, the proof is in the pudding of what they achieved in pre-wartime Germany. And that's proof in itself that it worked, right?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, and that's what has to be hidden from the world.
It has to, yeah. So why is there any other? There's nothing else that has been more demonized in the history of the world, as far as I know, in terms of what they achieved to do. And I'm one of those suspicious people. So I wonder what that goes in line with. Because I mean, think about it. People are. They're very, in the conspiracy movement even, and the alternative and what have you, they're very cynical as well, which can be a good thing, you know, in terms of being suspicious about the elite and the globalists and everything else. But on this particular point, they fall in line with the propaganda and they yield to it. They don't dare to scratch that surface and wonder, wait a minute, what is behind that? And I think that's a big key in itself to the battle that's waging here, you know?
Yeah, well, you know, it's a big taboo. It's a big, big taboo. Right from the early days in our schooling, you know, it's immediately drilled into us as the Germans are the most evil people on the planet and that's ever existed in the history of mankind. You know, don't ever go there. Don't go there. It's just they do everything they can to keep you away from that door.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm the type of person that when people start to try and censor me or try and hide things, that's the door I want to go through.
Sure.
That's
is.
What the real information is, you know. And I think what's happening is that there is an initial backlash. There's been an initial, you know, screaming banshees trying to keep us away, but I don't think they're going to be able to do it. I think there's more and more people becoming aware, thanks to Dennis's film, that there is a lot of evidence to prove, you know, quite substantially, a different perspective than the official narrative that we're giving about the Second World War. Because the thing is that their whole paradigm, their modern paradigm of cultural Marxism, political correctness, is underpinned by this myth of the Second World War.
Exactly.
Everything is staked upon it, you know. If they lose that foundation, then the whole cultural Marxist agenda will fall with it. You know, so it's absolutely in their interests and absolutely central to everything that they're, you know, trying to achieve is to maintain this demonic myth, you know, about what happened 70 odd years ago.
Yeah, I think for all the people that were killed and the destruction of Germany and really the spirit of the German people, it's up to us in other parts of Europe now to stand up, to fess up to the truth and look at this objectively and stand up and help each other out to get out of the rut that we're in right now. I think it's very important for all of Europe to unite against the powers that are seeking our destruction, to get out of this rut and to look at this objectively, and it's our duty to look to find out the truth about this. Otherwise, I believe we won't make it, because so much, as you say, is hinging on these lies of history, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, the enemy is aware of this. They're racing towards the goal. You know, we're trying to become, you know, aware as quick as we can. But it's a big struggle, you know? And it's a massive problem. It's a huge problem. But I do see every single day people are waking up every single day. And if we can achieve the 100 monkey syndrome, you know, it may happen much quicker. But even there, I'm still not quite sure of what the solution is, or, you know, how things are going to unfold, because the world is very, very, very different than it was 70 years ago. Our nations are completely different. The idea of the nation state is a 19th century model that I think now is over. It's moribund, you know. And so what the future holds, the solutions, you know, are still up for grabs. You know, I don't think there's any clear way out of this. It's, you know, it's a heavy time.
Yeah, it is. It is. But it's a time for starting to organize and get our, you know, pieces in place here, because a lot of things are kind of unfolding fast, and it's with the plans in place, you know, for those who realize what they are. I think it's a really delicate period and a delicate time. And what, tell us a bit about what happened here next as well, because obviously, as you alluded to a little bit already, you kind of, in this period, you became aware of, you know, cultural Marxism, political correctness, how this has been used as a weapon, of course, to kind of conquer the West, really, destroy it from within, and you go down, you know, other paths here, and even, you know, as we've been talking about on the show now, the genocide of the Indo-European people and dispossession of our ancestral lands, that's what we're seeing happening, unfolding as a consequence of all of this. Tell us what kind of happened next when all this... This is really last year, right? So where did you go from here?
Yeah, so you know, this was a whole new world for me, a total new paradigm, you know, and I knew it was very controversial. I knew it was a dangerous path, you know, because I know that the programming, the Pavlovian programming, you know, is certain words, certain concepts, and certain ideas are drenched in emotional charge. You know, they propagandize certain words and certain concepts. They spend billions upon it, so that people who are unaware of certain facts and certain truths, when they hear certain words used against you in a certain context, they react emotionally. They don't react with reason. They don't try and work out what's being said or what the words even mean. They just react like a dog would to a bell when it's presented with food.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's what you have to navigate, and that's what's most dangerous and, you know, risky. So, you know, as I became aware of this new information, I knew it was my duty to share it. You know, I couldn't contain it, I couldn't hold it in, I just have to tell people, you know. It was the only way that I could deal with the guilt of condemning the Germans for so long, and I just started to share the link, the various issues that were raised in it, and I started to share and talk about it on my Facebook profile, and then, you know, I entered into the next stage of the game. So, this was happening. I changed my, you know, my whole political rhetoric was starting to change online, and start to talk about cultural Marxism, the Second World War, you know, the genocide of the Indo-European people. It was, you know, becoming part of my whole thought processes. And then in Liverpool, we have our own mini ZOG in Liverpool, yeah? ZOG is Zionist Occupied Government, as I'm sure you know.
Sure.
But in Liverpool, we have our own one. Liverpool is a heavily dominated Labour Party city. Yeah? It's like a little mini Marxist state, unfortunately, and has been for quite a long time. And it's, you know, what's most depressing about it is that people think that Marx, you know, was fighting for the people, was fighting for the working man. You know,
right.
That's the real disappointing element of it, is that he's nothing more than just a shill. He wrote a book about an economic theory, but never once mentioned the bankers, the Rothschilds, or usury. You know, his economic theory is totally failed, and more people have died in the name of Marx than any other political ideology on the planet. Hundreds of millions of people have died under the name of that monstrous ideology, and unfortunately, people are still attached to it on a level that they think that the workers, you know, are represented by this concept of Marxism. You know, what we should be asking is, why are we even calling ourselves workers, you know?
Yeah.
This ideology has quite a stronghold in Liverpool, and the Labour Party have quite a stronghold in Liverpool. We have five MPs in Liverpool that govern the city. All of them are Labour Party, and three of them are Jewish Zionists, Louise Ellman, Stephen Twigg, and Luciana Berger. Each of them has a distinction at one point in their career of being the chairman of Labour Friends of Israel. So we have five MPs, three of which are Jewish Zionists. That means 60% of our political governors in this city are Jewish Zionists. Yeah, and I don't think that's reasonable.
Where's the diversity, right?
I don't think that's reasonable. If they were 60% of our MPs were Muslim, there'd be absolute outrage.
Yeah.
But the fact that the Jewish Zionists were not allowed to talk about it, as you know, any criticism of those who rule over you, you'll soon know about it, you know. So 60% of our MPs are Zionists, and my own MP is Luciana Berger. And Luciana Berger, she was voted into office or parachuted into her position. You know, when she first arrived, she didn't know anything about the city. She's from London. She didn't know basic questions about basic Liverpool heroes. The circumstances in which she was voted as the person to take office was shrouded in fraud and, you know, just really bad circumstances. And she's my MP. And she was the youngest ever director of Labour Friends of Israel. Now, obviously, I'm anti-Zionist and fight for the plight of the Palestinian people, and I've done for a long time. And I take offence to Ms. Berger's position on Israel and also her position on many other things. And I decided to make my opposition vocal. I decided to make a few posts about it on Facebook, you know, and that kind of was an ongoing thing. And then not long after she was in office, my other councillor, an MP has three councillors working below them. One of them, a guy called Jake Morrison, was the youngest ever councillor voted into office at the age of 18. Now, I don't know who wants to be a councillor at 18. I was busy having fun at 18, but anyway.
The political monsters as machines being churned out.
Yeah.
Right?
Amazing, yeah. He was ousted by Berger in our local constituency because he refused to go on a course run by, I think, a guy called A.V. Cohen, who was a policy advisor to Obama. And Berger was trying to force him to go on some course. He refused, and she bullied him, and he left the Labour Party and blew the whistle and, you know, exposed Berger for her bullying tactics and caused quite a big stir in the city. And then my mother, who's a TV celebrity here in the United Kingdom, has been for like 30 years, she was on a demonstration, and the only politician that turned up was this kid, Jake Morrison. He told my mother the story about Berger. And she said she'll back him because he had decided to run as an independent MP against Berger. So she said, I'll back you and I'll do some campaigning for you. So she began to do some campaigning with Morrison in our local area. Got some TV coverage, you know, and generated quite a bit of heat against Berger, but also support for Morrison. So that was the end of that. And then not long after this, two blogs appeared. Now, these bloggers are proving to be really serious agitators in smearing people. Two blogs appeared. One written by somebody called Rhiannon Loughton and another one by Adam Ford, her boyfriend. And in these blogs, they attacked both me and my mother, calling me a fascist, a Nazi, an anti-Semite, a racist, you know, all the usual crap. Mm-hmm. And what happened is that this blog had been a piece of work, you know. She had must have sat and researched me and my postings online for months, you know. And what she was able to do was just piece together a narrative that she wanted to create, yeah, rather than, you know, I'm into a broad range of things. Now, she just wanted to create a certain picture. And it was after I'd seen the film and I started posting things about the film, you know. So she wrote this nasty defamatory blog about me and my mother, calling us racist and fascist, and that people should treat my mother with caution. Yeah.
Right.
And then not long after, the boyfriend did the same. Caused us quite a bit of trouble in our city, you know, caused us quite a bit of stress and strain. So this was the beginning of what turned out to be an 18-month politically motivated smear campaign against me and my mother to some degree. And it's no irony that it comes as a result of me talking about controversial nature of the Second World War. You know, and...
yeah, I mean, in their view, you post a video like The Greatest Story Never Told, and you're a Nazi, right?
That's just one aspect of my research. I've been at this for a long, long time, nearly 20 years.
It doesn't matter. You know, just collect the dirt that they see fit and then slam it together. That's what they do, right? It's character assassination. It's not about the truth or honesty. It's just about... that's their job, right? Discrediting these views, right? Yeah.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. It's like, you know, after a long period of research, yet they pick out this one piece, and that's what they go after.
Sure.
They're trying to define me by this little piece, you know? But like you say, it's a job. That's their job, is to agitate, to stop people organizing, to stop people, you know, becoming aware, to try and scare people back into the pen, you know?
Yeah.
And that's ultimately what their job is. And, you know, these blogs came out, done some damage, you know, but I decided to ignore them. I decided not to give them any oxygen. But what I did discover is that one of the bloggers, Rhiannon Loughton, she worked for Luciana Berger in Weymouth Street Labour Party, where I'm from. And she worked for her just a few months previous to writing the blog. Yeah? And I don't believe there's any coincidence in that. I believe that there is a politically motivated smear campaign, you know, emanating from Berger's office or close to Berger's office, because the coincidence is too much, you know. So that kind of unfolded and that began, and then I kind of let that go. Didn't really hear about it much again, and then December 2013, another, you know, big change in the narrative occurred when Russell Brand decided to tweet the people versus the banks. You know, he saw it, he loved it, and, you know, we tweeted it, and all of a sudden the film got a huge spike, you know, huge spike of attention, and lots more views, and, you know, it was shared all over the net again. And he asked to meet me, you know. So I agreed, and he played in Liverpool, we met, and we kind of got on, and I thought he was okay. I mean, up to this point, you know, is that I didn't really take much interest in Russell Brand. It was not something that I was following. And then he did that interview on Paxman, which, you know, I was really encouraged by. I was really encouraged by it at the time, because it was just great to see somebody who had a level of fame, if you like, but a platform to speak to millions of people. And the fact that he was talking about bankers, even though it was vague, and talking about revolution, even though it was vague, and talking about socialist revolution, which, you know, was vague. Ultimately, yeah. I still liked it. I still liked the fact that that was breaking through into the mainstream on a platform of his scale. So I was encouraged by it. And then I did some research, you know, on brand, and there's quite a few anomalies. Quite a few anomalies, you know, there's presumed interest in Marxism, and, you know, he was going out with Jemima Khan at the time, which poses a whole set of different questions, you know.
Yeah.
And then he was doing his guest editing spot on New Statesman, which is a Fabian Society, you know, paper.
That's right.
There was a whole host of other questions, but that made it interesting for me. That made it, you know, even more interesting. It was a puzzle, you know. So when he asked to meet me, it was like, okay, let's go and see what he's like. I met him in Liverpool, and I have to say, he was charming, he was friendly, he was engaging, and it was a good meeting, you know. And he said to me, would you be interested in doing a podcast next year in 2014? And I said, yeah, I would. And I didn't see him again then. I didn't hear from him for a few months. Meanwhile, another blog came out in 2014. This time again, you know, it was from a different blogger who was friends with Adam Ford, right? So you have Rhianna Loughton, her boyfriend Adam Ford, and his best friend Sean Cashman. These are like a trio of Marxist agitators. Yeah. He decides to write the blog, and this one's just rehashing the same information, but he goes a little bit further. Because I use the word goy, right? Because I use the word goy, I'm now branded as an anti-Semite. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. There's certain words they don't like, you know. There's certain words that they don't like, and goy is one of them.
Well, you didn't make up the word. It's rather a reflection of the opposition, isn't it?
Of course. No, of course. So anyway, that blog came up, and I faced some further heat from it, you know, and just again ignored it. And then I think about June, July of 2014, I got a call from Russell Brand asking me if I'd like to be interviewed for his new book. And, you know, I agreed. So I went to Jemima Khan's mansion in Oxfordshire, which was, you know, an interesting experience to be interviewed by Russell Brand for his book on revolution. And Russell's idea is he was to interview 10 or so people, and they were to influence his thinking in relation to the book, you know?
Yeah.
Other people included Stephen Fry, Naomi Wolf, Max Kaiser, Peter Tatchell, David Graeber, you know, various other people, and I somehow managed to get on that list. I think I was the wild card. I was the wild card.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Right, and so I first thought, this is an interesting experience. It's not often you get invited to these things, and I just thought, I'm going to do it. I'm just going to go and do it and just, you know, see where it leads. So goes to Khan's gaff in Oxfordshire, and, you know, meet Brand, spend a bit more time with him. And again, you know, he's an interesting and engaging guy. You know, you can't take it away from him, and he's got some interesting things to say. We didn't really speak much, you know, at Jemima Khan's, and then we did the interview, and the interview, I was just talking about my idea of revolution, which is, you know, we have to reform monetary policy. We have to rewrite the constitution. If we're going to live amongst the state, we have to rewrite the constitution so that it protects us from the predatory bankers coming in and destroying the country again. We have to have a system of decentralized power, which is revolves around the idea of direct democracy, kind of based upon the Swiss system and also on the early ideas of the American system. You know, and I was saying that can only be achieved through non-violent, peaceful revolution. You know, and that was kind of what I was putting forward, and he liked it. You know,
but nothing about the Zionist bankers or the miracle of national socialism in all of this, right?
Not at that stage, no.
No,
no, I wasn't talking about that. Cause,
yeah.
You know, from what I gathered from Russell is that he's recently woke up, yeah, from what I can gather, this is just my judgment. It may be incorrect, it's just my judgment. But he spent the last 20 years being famous, being a celebrity, you know, indulging in that celebrity and fame, maybe reading too many copies of Tatler and Vogue, and not enough research on the internet. So I think what's happened is as he's become aware of actually what's happening, and it's compelled him to say something and speak out, he's reached out for the first thing that people do when they wake up to this is, you know, Karl Marx's Communist Manifesto. Yeah. And so I'm still, you know, undecided on whether he's a committed communist or whether he's just flirting with it. You know, I kind of get the idea that he's, you know, he's for the people as far as I can see. You know, I didn't really get a bad vibe off him, if I'm honest. You know, I kind of got a confused vibe, if anything.
Right. Yeah.
So that was the interview went well. We got on well. You know, talked about the bankers, talked about peaceful, non-violent revolution, monetary reform, direct democracy, and that was the end of that. And I didn't speak to him again for a while. And then a couple of months later, on the back of doing the brand interview, I was asked to do a speech at World Merit Day, which is it was in Liverpool, big event. It was in a big arena. It's kind of a cultural Marxist event, you know. And somehow, again, I managed to get on the bill. And I decided I was going to do a talk about usury. Because even though up to this point I'd had a knowledge of banking and stuff, it was now I was really beginning to solidify my understanding of the mechanism that's causing us all these problems, which is usury, you know. And I read a book called The Banking Swindle by Kerry Bolton, which I highly recommend. And in this book, Kerry Bolton is like a PhD historian, lives in New Zealand, faces attacks from the Marxists all the time because he presents a version of history that they don't like. And in this book, he lays it out. He lays out the historical struggle against usury and the bankers. And he lays out what happened in the 20th century, in the early part of the 20th century, and the struggle of many, many nations across the planet that were fighting against it.
Yeah, wasn't Kerry Bolton the author of Psychopathology of the Left as well?
Yeah, The Psychosis of the Left.
Yeah, that's a really interesting, that's a good book, you know.
Yeah. He's a good author, he's a really good author. So basically I read that book and it gave me a deeper knowledge, and I was speaking to a Dutch friend of mine called Anthony Miguels. I'm sorry, Anthony, if I got your surname wrong with a Dutch pronunciation. He runs a website called realcurrencies.com, and he gives a brilliant analysis, absolutely brilliant contemporary analysis of usury economics and interest-free currency. So I was speaking to Bolton, I was speaking to Anthony, and I formulated a kind of a presentation on usury in this big arena in Liverpool. It was a 20-minute presentation, and it was about 300, 350 people, and it was mainly young people, you know, which was good. And I delivered it, and it went well. I got a great round of applause, and I was encouraged by it, you know. But what's interesting is that also on the same bill is that Luciana Berger, was on a panel with my mother talking about feminism. I think the panel was expecting my mum to go along with the party line, because in her younger days she was, you know, a flag bearer of that ideology, but since then she's awoken herself, and she was saying, no, we need to be protecting our men, not beating them up.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
it didn't go down well on the panel.
Oh, my God. That's funny. Well, at least, you know, at least I can give them one thing, and then at least they were, well, initially, we'll get to this, but at least initially they were giving a veneer of, all right, you know what, let's just get the different sides in here, let's just talk about it, let's get it out there, right? But this is not what happened, of course.
I don't think so. I don't think they were expecting what we presented.
Ah,
I think,
okay.
So I think if they would have known, we wouldn't have got the gig.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
So it was. It came from an interesting angle. So anyway, that went really well. And then a few months later, I got a call from Brand asking me if I wanted to take part in a project which was to help the struggle of vulnerable women who were facing eviction by the local council. And he said, you know, it'd be good to get your opinion on it. And I was like, yeah, okay, that sounds like a project I'd get behind. And he invited me to London. So I went to London and took part in this demonstration outside Bow County Court, in which, you know, again, it's back to this idea of moving people from their communities, you know. And we've got the idea of life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness, yeah, which are primary rights. And happiness comes from being amongst your community. Yeah, and your community is your family, your friends, your identity, your roots. You know, your whole being is, I believe, is, you know, expressed through your community. And this is why they've tried to destroy communities. And this is why they have destroyed communities. Margaret Thatcher began the process when she said, there is no such thing as society, there is only the individual. And then she, you know, set up underway the whole process of smashing the strength we have in our communities. And it continues today with evictions. Evictions is a great way of breaking up a community, you know.
Yeah.
And there's these vulnerable women who were living in hostels for whatever reason, and the council had said, we're closing down the hostel, you know, some capitalist probably wants to buy it, and we're going to rehouse you, but we're going to do that in far-flung corners of the country. So they were in London, and they were talking about relocating one of them 200 miles to Manchester, another one 250 miles to Glasgow. It was just a diaspora of these vulnerable women, you know. And they resisted, and they said no, and they occupied a group of empty council houses. There was nothing wrong with these houses at all, actually, you know, in really good condition. The council had just left them empty for economic, political purposes. So these women, as is their right, occupied these properties and said, well, if you're not using them, we'll use them, you know. And they maintained an occupation over these flats for quite some time, and then ultimately it went to court, and I went down, you know, not giving me advice, I just shared my experience and some of the little tips and things that I've learned along the way. And there was a big demonstration outside the court, and what was the tagline they had? It was social housing, not social cleansing. That was their... which I thought was quite apt, you know.
Right.
It was quite apt, because what we are experiencing is a social cleansing. The social cleansing of the indigenous people of these islands, you know.
Yeah.
And all the press were there, and Brand and his team were there, and you know, we filmed. You know, he does something called The Trues. Have you heard of The Trues?
Yeah, briefly ran into one of his banners or whatnot, but I'm not too familiar with this. What is that?
Okay, so he's got The Trues, which is his alternative news channel on YouTube, and actually some of them are really good. There are some of them really good, but others are completely, you know, off message in my view, and he maintains a cultural Marxist agenda without really knowing what it is, if I'm honest, you know.
That makes it even better, doesn't it?
yeah.
Right.
I don't really think he gets what's really happening at the deeper level, you know, but I'm hoping that he will. He's a smart guy. He's a reasonable guy. So I'm hoping that, you know, when presented with the facts, he will change his position as reasonable people do, you know?
Yeah.
So we'll soon see. The Trues channel is his daily, almost daily platform in which he presents an alternative view from what the mainstream media present. Unfortunately, he's telling it just from the left perspective, when it should be transcending both left and right. You know, that's where we need to be getting, because the left and right paradigm is a creation of the bankers and whoever it is that's in their cabal to keep the people fighting each other rather than them, you know. So that's The Trues, and he was there filming for his channel, and he posted a video with me and him in it of the day. Yeah, posted it on his channel, and he gets a lot of traffic. He gets a lot of traffic for each video.
Of course he does. People love celebrities, don't they? Even if it's alternative people and people who know about conspiracy or the bullshit of Hollywood, but they love it.
You know why, I believe, is because we don't have the gods that we used to have as part of our myths. We don't have the connection to our history, our roots through our myths, our gods, etc. So
yeah, you're right.
They've been replaced by these celebrities, and you know they fill a need that we have, and they you know fill a vacuum that people are crying out for. Unfortunately, you know,
and that's when they lead us astray as well, right? That's why a lot of these celebrities are. They are bought and paid for, and Hollywood and the establishment make damn sure that someone who actually would begin to approach the truth doesn't get the platform. That's why I usually am very suspicious of those who come from that environment and trying to, you know, enlighten us with their wonderful messages, you know?
I totally agree with you, and it's a good rule of thumb, isn't it? You know, if they come from that direction, be very cautious.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he played it on his Truth channel on YouTube. It, you know, generated a lot of views, a lot of traffic. But what happened is that it activated the Marxist agitators against me. Yeah, they saw me next to their hero,
right, yeah.
And it caused them to go into a kind of a meltdown. You know, They've started posting the blogs on any platform that that Russell Brand was on. They were just going, fascist, 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 fascist. It was like something out of a Monty Python film.
Exactly.
They just harassed Russell Brand, right, with these crazy blogs with no evidence, just rubbish, you know, just rubbish.
Yeah.
You know, new blogs started to appear. They were starting to go a little bit crazy. And,
yeah, the Daily Parrot, right?
Yeah. It was mad, right?
And, yeah.
And at the same time, you know, Russell didn't say anything. He didn't mention it, you know? So he either didn't see it or he didn't think it was a problem at that time, you know? And then he called me and said... he's launching his book. He's having a debate in the book launch because the book launch was like it was called an anarchic fair because Russell kind of leans towards anarchism, or he thinks he does, and I like that. I support that. That's the position I take, you know. But I think he's still at the same time also leaning towards Marxism, which you know, if you know about the history of Marx and Bakunin, you know that anarchism and Marxism are mutually exclusive, they don't mix. Marxism is about authoritarian government, which is the dictatorship of the proletariat, and anarchism is about self-rule. They cannot mix together, so you cannot be an anarchist and a Marxist at the same time if you want to have any credibility, in my view.
Yeah, and despite that, the a lot of the anarchist movement has hijacked by the Marxists and the left as well. They usually do that same way they jumped on the Green Movement, basically. And trying to piggyback on, you know, the minorities issues or the, you know, political correct issues. They use anything they can to attack their enemy, which is, you know, Western civilization and, you know, development and all these other things. And this is what they do. But, I mean, that's a huge worrying issue. I mean, how long can you go within that environment and not realizing, for example, the genocide that has been done in its name? And I am still shocked that the hammer and sickle is perfectly fine on the streets of Europe while a swastika is banned. I'm shocked about that, actually.
In my younger days, I went to a few demonstrations in London for Palestinians and the Lebanon conflict, and I went and just marched. And what I was, even at that time, I knew about the Russian genocide. I've known about the Russian genocide for a long time, and I've known about the terrible, terrible... the time that the Russian people faced at the hands of the Bolsheviks, yeah? And what I found incredible at those marches, which is still the same today, is that the hammer and sickle is flown everywhere with pride and abandon. Right?
Yep,
and,
yep.
You know, it's incredible. Like you say, you know, if you would stick a swastika up, you'd be jumped. You'd be jumped. You'd be killed, probably.
Yeah, if you get a knife in your back and that's it.
Yeah, but yet this completely murderous ideology, everywhere it's gone, it's just created mass murder on an epic scale. Right? But yeah, it's culturally accepted to fly the hammer and sickle. It's incredible.
It's incredible, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Right, so Russell Brand decides that he's going to do a launch of his book. He's going to call it an anarchic fair, and it's going to be a day of debate, music, stalls, etc. It sounded like a really interesting day, to be fair. And he said, he asked me if I wanted to be on the debate. Well, okay, why not? Well, I didn't agree straight away, because I asked who was on the panel. And panel was Helena Norberg Hodge, who is an ecologist who's got some brilliant ideas on localism being the solution to globalism, which I completely agree with. I mean, that is the solution. You know, we have to decentralize power from the banks. I mean, it has to come back to the people on a local level. You know, it really does. John Baird, who is the creator of The Big Issue, which is a magazine here that the homeless people sell so that they don't have to beg. Francesca Martinez, who was a comedian with cerebral palsy. And Peter Tatchell, who is a gay rights campaigner. He calls himself a human rights campaigner. And that was the panel. And I was okay with everyone other than Tatchell, because I knew Tatchell has got a big reputation and knew he'd be trouble. And, you know, when I was considering doing the debate, there was something niggling me, you know, telling me that this is going to be trouble. You know, this is going to be trouble, especially when I saw Tatchell's name.
Why is that? Tell us a bit about him.
Well, Peter Tatchell is, probably one of the key cultural Marxist campaigners in the United Kingdom. The past 20 years, he has, been fighting for various campaigns, mainly gay rights. But he was quoted, in the 90s, in The Guardian, part of a book review. He said, "Not all sex with children is unwanted."
Wonderful.
Yeah. He since said he was taken out of context. However, if you were the writer of that piece, I'm sure you'd have something to say. And nothing's been said. But anyway, that was the cloud that he was under, that allegation. But also, he's currently campaigning for the lowering of the age of consent. In England, it's currently 15. I think he's trying to get it down to 12. And his argument is that he doesn't want to see children criminalized for having sex. Right? Now, the thing is one, what's it got to do with him? Yeah? He's got no children. And two, if children below the age of 15 have sex currently, they're not prosecuted. If a blind eye is turned by the law, because they understand the law is there to protect children from predatory older people. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not there to demonize and criminalize children. Anyway, that's another issue. But
yep. Yep.
He is part of a campaign to lower the age of consent, and some people would say that's part of the normalization of paedophilia, which is a deadly concern right now amongst Western countries. It's especially in the United Kingdom, the scandal, absolute outrageous scandal of this paedophile VIP scandal coming out now. It's they can't keep a lid on it. It's just growing and growing and growing.
Yep.
So that was bearing on my mind, and I thought, this is going to be trouble. Something's going to happen here. And I was preparing myself for it, really. I didn't accept the invitation until the last minute. And Brand put up a poster which had my name on it as one of the people on the debate, and this was 2 days before the debate. And what I wasn't prepared for was the sheer scale of the witch hunt against me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is on Twitter, and I'm not on Twitter. I mean, I have an account, but I don't use it. I use Facebook. I think I will start using Twitter, but It was, you know, it was epic in the scale. It was these faceless trolls. All of a sudden, about five blogs appeared, propagating more lies. One of them actually called me a bailiff. He said, I'm secretly a bailiff, as well as a Nazi, as well as a fascist, as well as a racist, as well as an anti-Semite, as well as a Holocaust denier. Mm. So they threw the kitchen sink at me.
Yeah,
anyway.
Checking all the boxes. Yeah, good.
Yeah, they threw the kitchen sink, you know.
You're just that dangerous to them, I guess, huh?
So, what can I possibly say that is so dangerous?
I love when that happens, specifically when the people who get charged with those accusations just say, so what? Who cares? You know,
yeah.
What's it to you? You know,
because
the point here being, right? I mean, Thatcher, one of the reasons here why he was so concerned, right, is because I think this is the pull from Independent here. Mr. Eastman may not share all the same political views as him in this case, right? So, well, okay, and so what?
That's the whole point of a debate, isn't it?
Isn't it? Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What's the point of a debate if everyone agrees with each other?
Where the hell does this guy come from? Where was he educated? Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway,
well,
yeah.
Know exactly what to do. So anyway, so this campaign, this like incredible witch hunt was just, you know, undertaken against me, and they were harassing not only Russell Brand on his Twitter, but they were also harassing all the other panelists, you know, constantly, and just, you know, calling me all different types of smear names in an attempt to, you know, disrupt and subvert and sabotage the actual debate. You know, in England, I don't know whether it's the same in America, but Antifa, you know, the deranged, psychotic left-wing lunatics, they have a policy of no platform. Have you heard about this?
Well, I mean, they're huge force, if you will, in Sweden, where I am, and that's, I mean, they've been extremely violent. It's one of the most violent groups we have in Sweden, actually, and finally, the police in Sweden are actually turning towards some attention towards them and recognizing that they're actually one of the most dangerous groups out there. We recently had a stabbing, actually. One guy who was out on a march, you know, got stabbed in the back. So I know all about them, and it's well overdue that people start recognizing the dangerous group that they are and the violent group that they are.
If anything, they're the fascists.
Oh, sure. Well, you know, again, the conception of what they believe the fascists are like, that's what they're fulfilling that box. You know what I mean?
Yeah, of course, yeah. But, you know, no platform just means censorship. It means the, you know, the lack of freedom of speech. It means that they're trying to silence you. And that has to go against any civilized country, you know?
Yeah.
It goes to the heart of, you know, what we're about, doesn't it? If we can't speak our mind, then what kind of place are you living in? Well, you know, a totalitarian communist regime is what it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they began their campaign against me and tried to smear me on an epic level, to the point where, up to this point, remember as well, they were all faceless. It was anonymous blogs. It was anonymous Twitter profiles. I didn't know who they were, you know. I didn't know who was the attacker or where it was coming from. And it was Peter Tatchell who decided to put a face to the campaign when he took it on as his cause celeb and, you know, made out as if I was this demonic Hitler figure that shouldn't be allowed to speak. And bear in mind, Peter Tatchell is a human rights campaigner, self-styled human rights campaigner. Now, what Peter Tatchell was doing was denying me my human rights. You know, that's the irony of it. That's the hypocrisy
of it. Yeah, but see, you're wrong. So, you know, he can't allow you to speak, right?
Yeah.
No. But you're wrong. That's why. Right.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. I love how these human rights activists are like some of the biggest authoritarians that there is, and the most propagators of so-called tolerance. But we know about it. I mean, this is one-way tolerance. This is the very playbook of the Marxists, you know, in the Frankfurt School, that this is what they do. Suppress the other side, ridicule it, do anything you can to smear it and destroy it, and then, you know, just uplift your own view. So that's the basis where they're, that's the game they're playing, rather.
well, this is the first time I've seen the whites of their eyes, you know. I've seen it from the sidelines, but this is the first time I've been involved in the game, as it were, of this political correctness, and it was amazing, you know.
Yeah, it's a dirty thing.
Yeah. So anyway, Pete Patchell takes up the cause and says to Russell Brand basically that, you know, if I he's not going to take part in the debate if I'm on the panel, right? So he pulled Russell's bluff and made out as if I'm some kind of criminal who should be investigated. And nobody at any point has asked me what my views are.
Oh, of course not. No.
You know, nobody has asked me what my views are at all. I've just been hung, drawn, quartered. He's guilty. Let's hang him. Don't worry about it. That's you know, basically what was being played out.
Yep.
He's a heretic. Hang him.
There you go. Now you're touching upon it here. What do we have here? We have a new class of, witches and heretics on our hands that are daring to question history and daring to question the elite and the globalists and the banking system and everything that's been done to the human race for the last, few hundred years, if not even more, right?
Of course. It's the new religion that has been created as a result of the Second World War. You know, political correctness is a religion in that its believers adhere to it dogmatically without applying reason to what it is that they're behind.
Yep.
And when somebody, brings forth questions that make them try and apply reason, then they go into this emotional breakdown and want to express it through violence, burn the witch. You know, and that's kind of what it felt like, burn the witch.
If you're in Thatchell's eyes such a big bozo and everything you say is wrong, why not just prove you're wrong then and debate you on it, right?
Exactly, and that's what he denied me. He denied me the opportunity for me to express my views and defend myself and defend my character, So I knew I was facing an ordeal either way, right? Now, so Tatchell decides to, play his card and call Russell Brand's bluff. And Russell Brand, called me up and said, getting a lot of stuff sent my way. Are you a Nazi? Are you an anti-Semite? Are you a fascist?
Right, yeah.
So Russell, none of those words describe me or my work, right? And I told him the story. I told him that I'm the victim of a political smear in Liverpool. And he was, to be fair to him, he was very reasonable and he accepted it. And he said, clear your name. Clear your name. That was his advice.
Repent, right? You have to forgive the people for having divergent beliefs about history and what actually has happened, right? So it's not about the fact of investigating whether you're right or wrong or looking into these things for themselves or whatnot. It's about you crawling back to them, begging for forgiveness that you looked at a video, a year ago, right?
Yeah, of course. That's exactly what they want, and that's exactly what they tried to achieve.
Yeah.
And they failed.
Yeah.
I spoke to Brand about that. This was the day before, but the intensity of the trolling by these anonymous, faceless Twitter accounts became so much that even the other panelists were starting to ask questions, and Brand pulled the plug after Tatchell put him under more pressure. And he sent me a text saying, I'm going to save it for another day. I don't want to do it if you're not doing it, which was a nice message at the time, because I was under quite a bit of stress, a bit of pressure. It wasn't a nice experience, It wasn't a nice experience being treated like a pariah, And I've actually done nothing at this point. I hadn't even spoken, I hadn't even made a post. I was just keeping my own counsel. And, witnessing this attempted assassination of my character was a stressful situation. And I knew I couldn't do anything until after the event. I knew it had to burn itself out before I could, defend and, make a counterattack, as it were.
You know what I think it is? Please carry on after this, but I think it's also... I mean, first of all, I thought controversy is good, right? There's no such thing as bad publicity, even in the eyes of brand and his book launchers, you think that they jump on the opportunity. But second to that, you know, again, it goes back to the idea that you, Lawrence, are not allowed to talk about the things that I suspect that you would talk about during a debate like that. And we can't have anybody falling outside of the realm of that controlled narrative and the dialogue of what they want to have things when it comes to the mainstream view of things. This is now lurking into, you know, more mainstream fields due to the traction that Brand and some of these other people have there. And if you were to address some of these things, if you would spawn some ideas here in people's heads, no, we can't have that, because these guys, in my view, they're controlled opposition. They're there to steer this very understandable grassroots movement that is, you know, growing in the world because of the fact that people are fed up with the banking system, they're fed up with the political system, and their job is to steer this down the hole of another group that is going to utilize it for their own purposes, bring more, you know, power into their own hands, etc. You're outside of that narrative, and that's why you're not allowed. That's my belief, anyway.
Well, I agree with you completely. You know, it was that, you know, a book launch about a book called Revolution, and the first sign of real revolution, it was cancelled, you know.
There you go.
That was the irony of it.
Folks, the revolution has been cancelled because people are upset on Twitter. So there you go. That's the oomph of what it has to bring, right? So.
See, you know, I'm a kind of a enthusiastic about mythic structure, you know, and the idea of the monomyth and the journey that you have to go through to experience, you know, new things and new ideas and rebirth, as it were. And I knew leading up to the debate that I was facing an ordeal either way, whether it was going to be live at the debate or, you know, proceeding. And I knew what was about to come as an ordeal because, you know, I've been aware of the smear attacks against me for the last 18 months and I just kind of ignored them, you know, hoped they'd go away. But I knew leading up to this, I thought, this is it. This is going to be an ordeal for me, you know. And I was preparing myself for it. And it was exactly that. It was an ordeal. But, you know, coming through the other side is liberating. You know, it's not as bad as it looked going in. And also it's freed me up to speak about the things that I want to speak about without worrying about, you know, what I'm going to be called, because they've already called me everything they're going to call me.
Yeah,
They've got nothing left in the locker, you know. So I was, you know, it was an interesting experience. It was just an interesting experience, and it continued, you know, it continued for the next few days, and then once it kind of calmed down, I began my counterattack. First of all, I put up a press statement on my website dealing with Tatchell, you know, and the hypocrisy of a man of Tatchell's nature criticizing me, you know, and tell, you know, making out that I didn't have a right to speak. That what was I going to say that was so dangerous?
Mm-hmm.
What was I going to say that was so bad that it took the, you know, Tatchell to sabotage Russell Brand's party, you know? And they didn't even want to find out, you know, and it's kind of like I spoke about usury publicly and I was crucified culturally, you know.
Yep.
And you don't want to go there. They just don't want to go there.
You can't, you're not allowed to talk about these things. And folks, that should tell you something. That should give you a hint of what's going on here and who's pulling the strings here. Because, I mean, it's funny though as well, because these spokespeople are always like the, you know, the champion of the suppressed and the little guy and those who've been, you know, the LGBT, you know, kind of community. And, you know, they're so, of course, suppressed in our society, and, you know, we have to do everything we can to appeal to these people and whatnot, you know, but, oh my God, do you have a divergent political opinion? That's throw you in the fire, Lawrence, no problem, you know, just, we're not going to stand up for you. But what's good here, I think, is that they're operating on, you know, maximum capacity, basically, of what they're trying to achieve here. As you said, they've thrown every pot from the kitchen sink at you and tried every name they can, while, you know, people like us in the opposition to this, to these kinds of systems, haven't really even awakened yet to our full potential of what can be done here. They almost operate on like 100% well, we're not even, you know, on 10% yet. So we have a lot more to give, and there's a lot more people like you who stand behind you, who understand what you're talking about, and that's a growing demographics. And I believe that these people ultimately are so afraid because they know that they are on the losing end of things. They've had Marxism now in operation since the Second World War, pretty much, at least on a cultural level. They've run out of ideas. There's no steam there left anymore. This is why we have the reason why these violence groups are becoming violent, you know, like Antifa and all this stuff. They know that they're on the losing end of things. They can't keep it up any longer. They're fighting and thrashing to maintain the you know, what they have and whatnot. It's not going to work. It's over for them. As soon as people wake up to what's going on and the real story behind the banking system and all this stuff, that's going to be it for them. And that's what they're fear. That's what they're afraid of.
Definitely, it's the last stage, isn't it? The violent, you know, the death throes of a moribund ideology. You know.
Yep. That's right.
We just need to wake people up as quick as we can, you know, and I think it's happening. I really do.
It is. It definitely is. I know it, and I see it everywhere, and people are, you know, it's just the proof is the results of what we have and the kind of world that we've created today, you know, and that's what they have at their disposal right now. That's also the ammunition we can use against them. It's like, are you going to try to push for more of the same and more of what we've had? And that's why I have my huge reservations, as you might know, in terms of Russell Brand and the perspective he comes from and the way that he's, you know, proposing his socialist utopia and all these kinds of issues. And I think as long as you're hanging on that weak Marxism branch, you know, I can't take that seriously, you know.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think, you know, I read his book, and his book's kind of, you know, it's revolution light, if you like, you know, and it's more about spiritual philosophy than it is a political philosophy. I'm hoping that he's just, you know, on his own journey, and he's open to ideas, and he's open to the reality of things, and he can change his position. As I've changed my position over the years, I started at the beginning of this on the left, you know, in the Marxist thing, at the very, very beginning when I was young, and, you know, early 20s, came through that whole Marxist thing.
As we all do, pretty much, in America now too, I'd say, but in Europe, because, again, this is the prevailing ideology of our times. This is the morality that it's imposed on us in school and university and everything else. And that's why we come from that perspective. They are controlling the shots. They're not the opposition here, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So we've had these, you know, movements coming out and as you said, revolution, you know, light. And we've had so many of these revolutions throughout history. And my question has always been, where has it led us, and have we moved in the right direction? And we've had a lot of bloodshed in their name as well, and I've even questioned the very aspect of the kind of revolution, even calling it that. I don't know what your view on that is, Lawrence, but where do you think we should go from here in terms of how to begin to bring more attention to the kind of thing that you've been talking about and breaking down the banking system without falling into this trap of making it a Marxist revolution?
Well, you know, recently I've been involved in a case against the police. I sued them for trespass the land, assault and battery, and false imprisonment. And I have a strong case. The case itself revealed the lengths that even the police are prepared to go to in order to maintain this scam, and that they lied on oath in front of everybody. And I was convinced that not only were the police, the bailiffs, the barrister, but also the judge was working together. It was quite obvious to everybody there that it was, you know, really, really, really blatant that they ruled against me without providing the relevant authority. And it was in that moment I realized there's no remedy here. There's no remedy or relief in this statist idea. And I know I'm increasingly convinced that resisting the system by going toe-to-toe with it won't yield the results that we want at this moment. We need to self-determine as people. We need to realize our individual sovereignty. We need to self-govern. We need to just break away from the system that is trying to impose their tyranny upon us. We need to create our own interest-free currency. We need to work in smaller groups. We need to localize. You know, we need to do decentralization, voluntary association. In essence, we need to create an anarchy. You know, we need to create a true anarchy in that take away the banker's power, because usury is the most powerful force on the planet and it centralizes all power in its grasp. While that's in operation, we won't be free. You know, so we have to just walk away from it and create our own world, if you like. You know, and that's kind of where I'm heading. I've given up. I've given up on the state providing me with any remedy. You know, and this idea of self-determination is potent and it's powerful, and it's a primary right under international law. You know, if the people have had enough of the governments under which they're under, they have a right to separate and go their own way. And it's as ancient as humanity. And I think that's, you know, right now that's looking like the most attractive prospect, the most, you know, promising solution. You know, what's interesting is, you know, Switzerland is an incredible anomaly in the world. You know, it's one of the most successful countries on the planet. It's one of the richest countries on the planet. It's got some of the best standard of living. However, Switzerland has never had a monarchy. That's got to be one of the only countries in Europe never to have a monarchy. Switzerland is a pseudo-crypto anarchy in that it's built on direct democracy. The local boroughs are individual and sovereign, and they carry the power. You know, and the power goes from the people at the ground right up to the federal state. And I think there's something to be learned from the model Switzerland have created. Maybe not their banking practices.
Well, you know, I was just going to say, you know, they have also had the first, the World Zionist Organization in Basel. They've had a lot of the World Banks coming out of here, you know, so it's an interesting place for sure.
Maybe that's the secret of their success. Maybe anarchy is what the Zionists operate, and they sell monarchy to the Goyim.
Yeah? Right,
Maybe that's the secret of their success. And because they don't want us to be powerful on an individual level. They want us to transfer our sovereignty to a sovereign. You know, they want us to give up our rights to an individual or a government, in the hope that they protect us. But it's been repeatedly shown that they will fail to protect us in every corner and every turn. So I think that's what we have to start thinking about, is on a local level, working together, even tribally, you know, under this idea of anarchy and freedom, just to be left alone so we can go and self-determine our own destiny, you know?
Yeah, let me add something there, and I think it's ultimately down the road, I think you're right. I think, however, that it's too early for anarchism. I think that organization and coming together and protecting against, you know, the enemies is what we need right now. And, you know, because there is a trade-off here to a certain extent. And that's just the reality of the situation, in much in the same way that I believe that other nations and tribes in the past wanted to live the way that they want to live. They wanted to be protected. Imagine like the Roman Empire, and you're a pagan heathen tribe up in Northern Europe or in Germania, you know. They perhaps, and this is what you're getting at too, they kind of had an anarchy of sorts. They were living under, of course, moral laws and rules and guidelines and honor and all these things, right? But at the same time, when they realized that there is a greater threat outside of them, they also needed to come to a position where they're, to a certain extent, hardened in their line. It means that there will be diminishing returns on things like freedom, or that you can do whatever you want to do for the sake of survival, of protecting yourself, of taking care of yourself. I like the idea of a very free and open society, but in these days, I become fairly skeptic that anarchism is the way to go now, because we have so many threats against us of population replacement, genocides on a massive scale, and this threat that we're faced with will need organization, it will need tough leadership, and it will need some strict rules to try to stabilize the plans that we have against us. I hope that makes sense, and if you see where I'm coming from, Lawrence.
It does, because, you know, we have two footings, don't we? We have a war footing and we have a peace footing, yeah? I think in a peaceful situation, then anarchy is the best solution. However, in a threat to our survival, then you take a war footing, don't you? You know, which is self-defense, and under such circumstances, you have to be organized, and there has to be a certain hierarchy, you know?
Yes.
But absolutely, I agree with that 100%. The problem we have right now is how do we achieve that? Our government is totally corrupt. You know, there is nobody fighting our corner inside government across Europe. You know, there is a rise of so-called right-wing parties who are seeking the freedom of Europe, if you like.
Getting out of the European Union, but they're still pro-European, you know? That's good.
This brings up an interesting perspective, because, you know, in Europe we have Front National, in France we have Front National, in England we have UKIP, and various other parties across Europe that are seeking the exit of the EU, which I support 100%.
Me too.
The quicker we get out of the EU, the better, you know, and that'll solve the immediate problem, because, you know, we've got to deal with the Caligari plan, haven't we? That's ultimately what we're subject to right now, is the European Integration Project.
The Caligari model, yeah, the founder of the ideological reasoning behind it. And he, of course, argued, for those who don't know, we've mentioned this many times on the program, but for new listeners, from his own book, Practical Idealism. He was a Mason, too, by the way, but he argued that there was a moral hierarchy in Judaism and that the European people had to be replaced with, becoming basically a mongrel race. He wanted to breed out the different European nations and basically put something in place which he called, that he said was more closer to the what he believed that the ancient Egyptians were like. That was his philosophy.
Right. And he's a very powerful figure. And, you know, the Caligari Award is given each year to European dignitaries that maintain his project. And the current holder is Herman Rumpy, is it? His name?
Yep, that's right, the current...
And the previous one to him was Merkel. Merkel won the award. Every 2 years it's given.
Yep.
The Caligari Award. So that's what we face in Europe. We face... EU, in my view, is nothing but a Bolshevik revolution.
Yeah, you're right.
And it's moved... No, I think Gorbachev said, didn't he, that the USSR didn't collapse, it just moved to the West, and it's now called EUSSR.
That's right, exactly. And they're, of course, using, you know, it comes in some other disguises of posing as so-called free market capital, you know, free market, but it isn't. It's really just capitalism and very much corporate control, you know?
Yeah, definitely. So you have this kind of fight back, it seems, in Europe against the EU project. And in Britain, we only really have one option if we want to come out of the EU, and that's UKIP. That's the only party at the moment who are even you know, holding a conviction of that position. Now, whether that's true or not, whether that's, you know, just another pressure valve political party to absorb the pains and the strains of the indigenous people who are feeling the pressure, we'll see. But what's interesting about UKIP is Russell Brand's connection, right? Because Russell Brand does many Trues episodes in which he openly criticizes UKIP, calling them racists.
Regular stuff, yeah.
Regular stuff, right? Now, UKIP, the history is really quite interesting. In the 1990s, James Goldsmith, Jemima Khan's father, billionaire financier, for many deals with Rothschild, decided to leave the reservation, and he wrote a book called The Trap. It's a 96-page book. In it, Goldsmith reveals the true nature of the EU. And he says, this is terrible, get out, you know, this is going to cause us the end of British sovereignty. And he wrote this book, it was hugely controversial, yeah, and it caused absolute storm when it came out. Now, the legend goes is that it caused that much trouble that James Goldsmith had to leave United Kingdom. He set up a fortress in Mexico, which was guarded by ex-SAS, because he pissed off a lot of powerful people by publishing the book. Eventually, when the dust settled, Goldsmith came back to England, and he created the Referendum Party in 1996, roughly. The Referendum Party was non-political. It just had one single issue, which was a vote on the EU, in or out. Yeah? It caused quite a bit of a stir at the time, and a lot of people were interested, and it was generating a lot of publicity, and the Tory party were, you know, feeling the heat on it. But at that time, it was Tony Blair, 1997, the Labour Party landslide. So he got swallowed up in that election, and Blair got into power. He died not long after, James Goldsmith, and the Referendum Party died with him. Now, the key backers of the Referendum Party was Goldsmith, his wife Annabel Goldsmith, and also a businessman called Paul Sykes. They were the three main funders of the Referendum Party. Once the Referendum Party died, from the ashes came UKIP. And Paul Sykes continued to fund UKIP. And it's suggested that Annabel Goldsmith also funds UKIP, because her son, Robin Burley, is a major funder of UKIP. Yeah?
Right.
So Jemima Khan's mother and her brother are involved, and her father were involved in UKIP to some degree. Yeah?
Interesting, because while I was reading a little bit about the trap here, one review here, Goldsmith points out the moral bankruptcy of the neo-right, every man for himself, and then within parentheses he said, particularly men, particularly white and wealthy. So is this the same, because this is very prominent now within Western academia and has been in a cultural dialogue for a long time. It's the same old kind of anti-WASP rhetoric, really, which is also part of the attack of the Angles and the Saxons and all old Northern European peoples, which has been going for many, many years now. Do you think that he's seeking to kind of fill the void here, starting a dialogue from another point of view on the attack on British people, or is it genuine, do you think?
I really don't know. I really, really don't know. But what there's a part of me that thinks that UKIP is the vehicle of the English elite who see their property holdings threatened by the Bolshevik project that is the EU.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, so they see, you know, another Russian revolution in which the Bolsheviks just took all the aristocracy's land, yeah? Part of me thinks that could be a play. I don't know for sure. This is just speculation. But
Well, and that's a reasonable enough platform to run on. You know, I've my wife is Russian, and she had her great-grandparents were everything was stolen from them, everything was taken from under their feet, some of their family members were flat out murdered, you know. I mean, I understand. I mean, this, when you hear about these stories and whatnot from family members, you realize the threat that this agenda poses. And I absolutely, although sure, it might be, as you say, it might be just for them a temporary aspect of, oh my God, I'm going to lose, you know, things I've made and built. And I mean, that's, again, I support that. I definitely understand that they want to preserve what they have, what they built and all that. That's reasonable. I guess in this case, it's one of those scenarios where we might walk the same path for a certain while, and then it might be a break off. But if this is the only viable party in the UK, as it is in many other countries, similar parties exist, I see no other way, as it is of now, to support the direction that they're going and making sure that priority one is to get out of the European Union. And then after that's achieved, then we can discuss where to go from there, right? What's your view on this?
Well, yeah, to a degree. It's that, you know, it's, first of all, you know, we have to know who's behind it. If it's just the pressure valve party that is, you know, just going to lead to another betrayal, you know, that needs to be determined, doesn't it, before you'd even consider it. You know, but it's the UKIP are on the rise, without doubt. They won an MP
a couple of months ago, Douglas Carswell. They've got another election, a by-election coming up in a couple of weeks, which the polls are saying that they're going to romp home to victory. Right, so I think it doesn't matter what we say, anyone says, the press, whatever, I think there is a momentum building now for UKIP that will be decisive in the next election 6 months away, which they may or may not have the balance of power in Parliament to, you know, form a coalition. That may happen. If it does, then it's going to be really interesting. You know, I think the next 6 months are critical, absolutely critical for the future of United Kingdom or Britain. I hate using that word, United Kingdom. I think it's absolutely critical. If the Labour Party, for instance, are voted in or they maintain government, then, you know, we're going to be in the EU for another 5 years. We're going to see five more years of mass immigration, huge amounts. They're going to ramp it up like you wouldn't believe. It's going to be flooding in because they're trying to finish the job quickly before you know, the indigenous people can rise up and stop it.
Yeah,
you know?
That's right.
We're at that point. We're at that absolute crisis point, you know. And UKIP, unfortunately, are the only party right now talking about coming out of the EU.
Mm-hmm.
It's
just
incredible. It's absolutely incredible. That's the only party saying it.
It is. And look at how they're demonized, too, in the press, you know, and all the European parties are. It's like, again, they see, you know, SS troops marching down the streets and swastikas, you know, on the wall of the people who support, you know, something like UKIP, which is, of course, just an extremist and ridiculous view to have. If they don't realize the elites, the globalist plan of how they're using mass immigration as a tool, for their own purposes of trying to destabilize the world, try to, you know, breed out the native peoples of Europe, population replacement, all of these issues, then they have their head in their sand and they're not realizing what the game is about right now and for what reasons this is happening. And why are not people speaking up about this? If this was to happen in any other country in the world, they would be up, there would be candlelight marches everywhere, just as they did with the Tibetans when the Chinese invaded. Why is that? Why is it that white European peoples cannot have interests of their own and protect and preserve them? We can stand up for every other ethnicity in the world. The bottom line here, too, by the way, which is another thing I want to mention, Lawrence, and that has to do with, you know, every so-called minority that comes to the European countries through immigration, they're, first of all, really global majority in most cases. In many cases, it's the Europeans' ethnicities in themselves that actually are minorities on the world scale. But my point is, if they're concerned with the fact that there's not enough of them in the country that they're coming to, or that they feel, you know, not at home, etc., all these kinds of issues, well, guess what? You usually, if it's not a war created by the Zionists, you have a country to return to. There is a country there for you. If you're Filipino, you know, you can go back to the Philippines, and it's going to be all people like yourself in that country. And that's great. That's how we want it to be, right? But there's no country in the world anymore that is exclusively for the white, ethnic, native European peoples. For example, take Sweden or take England. There is no, as we're being flooded with immigration, there's no Sweden that I can return to and say, all right, here's where my people are at, and here's where the interests of my people are fulfilled. Sweden has now turned into a country which is a vehicle for every other nation in the world except my own. We as the people are not even protected under hate speech laws against its own people. What's happening is genocide. People have to recognize what is happening here and face, you know, the truth of the matter. I can't see it any other way, Lawrence.
I agree. You know, people are in denial. They're in denial. They're scared. They're protecting their careers. They're protecting their livelihoods. They see what happens when you speak out. In my case, you know, you're victimized. You're demonized. You're burnt at the stake. You know, a lot of people don't really want that. And it has to come to a point where a critical mass speak out so that it's safe territory for other people to join. And that's when we'll see a quick turning point. But the thing is that, you know, what happens once we're past the point of no return? What happens if, you know, UKIP turn out to be another false dawn? You know, where do we go then? Because the whole idea of the state protecting us is gone. It's over, you know? And then we're into completely uncharted territory about, you know, our future. how we organise politically. You know, this is an unknown. This is why I'm looking at two options. You know, if in the election we're able to get a referendum on Europe, then great, okay, we may be able to turn things around. But if we don't, then we have to look at other options, you know, because it's going to get a lot worse, in my view, before it gets better, if that's going to be the case.
I think we're going to see a lot of, you know, splinter groups trying to break off and, you know, preserve what they have, who they are, their culture, their ethnicity, and all these things. Because, I mean, think about it, once these demographics change, as they have been planned for us, this is going to be gone forever. It's never going to return. It's going to be gone off the face of the earth. And this is what they're seeking to do, of course, and blending everyone out. And, you know, the aspect, if you don't understand this point of having your feet rooted in the ground of your own ancestors, of being tied to the soil of where you are, that you're, those people who gave you life have toiled and died in the fields for you and for your people. And to see this just kind of being destroyed in the manner that it is, it's heartbreaking to me. And I don't understand how people can't see that there's been great wars fought over these territories to preserve and protect them and hold them in place. And now all this is just shatters, you know. And I think we're going to see a lot of people in kind of desperation try to do something about this and stand up against the government that has turned on its own people and no longer protect and preserve them, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, I would argue that it's not our government, it's a Zog, you know, and most, if not all, governments in the Western world are Zog.
Yeah,
you know,
they are.
And it's an enemy alien force that are there to destroy, you know, any threat to their hegemony, you know, and we are the only threat as it stands, you know, and that's why they want rid of us. But, you know, I agree. I think it's not all doom and gloom. I think the more we wake up, the more we can resist and the more we can push back, you know, against what's going on.
It's going quick now, actually, and a lot of people are realizing what is occurring, you know.
Hendrik, when you lose the fear, you know, that's the most liberating thing. And
yes,
that ultimately, that's been the beneficial effect of my ordeal, has been a rite of passage. It's been a rite of passage that has allowed me to lose the fear and speak openly as I'm speaking to you. You know, and that's, I can thank my Marxist detractors for that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you've gone through, I mean, it's a long journey. It is indeed an ordeal with all the things you've been doing. But again, you're kind of a living example of what can be done, and of course what can be learned, you know, along the way. And you I know that you do have things upcoming. For example, the you're planning an international user conference, right, in 2015 in Liverpool, correct?
Yeah, you know, so one of the good things about what happened is that I got a lot of support of people, and you know, Gilad Atman in particular, you know, I had a chat with him, and
yeah, he's great.
He's great and a real somebody I admire. I admire his courage, his fearlessness, and I admire what he's saying. He's saying it like it is. And had a long chat with him, and he's interested, and I'm speaking to a lot of other people. You know, I want to put on an international usury conference in Liverpool, hopefully, you know, because Jung, you know, Carl Gustav Jung said Liverpool is the pool of light. So I'd like to put on a conference there, because Sheikh Iman Hussein, he runs, or he attends, a conference in Malaysia every year called an international conference on riba. The Muslims call usury riba, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's condemned more than anything else in the Quran is usury. So he runs one in the East once a year, and I'm trying to set up one in the West. And in 2015, you know, I'd like to assemble all the greatest minds who are authorities on this subject, and also who can present solutions, you know, in terms of how we break free from the thing that's causing us the most problems. And, you know, the EU project is all run by usury, and the mass immigration is all run by usury. We remove that power, and their power goes with it. And I think it's something that needs to be discussed, it needs to be debated, we need to have it out in the open. And we need to work on solutions to solve it, you know?
Yeah, these are moral issues of survival and preservation, and those who don't understand that, well, they show me any man and woman who don't care about themselves, of who they are, or for, you know, their own people, or what they consider to be their community. This is the point. There are people who love multiculturalism. That's the type of society that they want to live in. And I'm not the one who say to stop that you can't do that or whatever. That's not what this is about. It's about respecting the will of the people. In fact, we've never been asked in Europe if this is what we want, if this is what we want to have occur in our countries, in our lands. And it's against people's will in most cases. And that's the crime in the scenario. And that's what we have to keep pressuring on and saying, you're welcome to have this. There needs to be, it's been in a natural state from the beginning of geography, division. Either some people, you know, call that God, some people call that nature. You can call it whatever you want. The reality of the situation is we have what we have, and we have beautiful differences within the human race. And I think it's a crime to deliberately try to destroy those and erode those. And so this is a moral issue for me, and it's about survival and preservation. And I like my people. I like what we are. I want to preserve that and protect that. So what would you say to, Mr. Brand, or, you know, if he's listening, or maybe anyone else who don't understand your point here? I guess we can begin with Mr. Brand. What would you like to say to him? Because I know you've not had a falling out, perhaps, but you haven't been in touch with him after the debate ended, and you don't really know where he stands on all of these issues, and if he's and if he would stand up for you and try to save your name a bit.
Well, I don't actually want to say anything to Russell, like a message to him. I think he's a guy with his heart in the right place. I think he's from roots very similar to me. We've got a lot of parallels in our life. And I just hope that the journey that he's on leads him to the right places. I hope that if he listens to this, he may go and investigate some of the things that I've brought up that we may have discussed on his debate panel. And, you know, I hope that that information leads him to the same truths that it's led me to. You know, and once you know what's really going on in your heart with conviction, it's, you know, you're duty bound. You can't do anything other than try and spread the word, you know. And I think any honest man, any reasonable man presented with those facts would do the same thing. You know, and that's all we really want. You know, I'm not against immigrants. I'm against mass immigration. You know,
yeah.
There's a difference. I'm not against people. Those people are just trying to make a better life for themselves, as would I. I don't blame them one iota. But what I do want from them, I want recognition. I want recognition of what's going on. That's all I ask. Because once we have recognition, once we have an awareness of the destruction of the Indo-European people and our ancestral land, then we can begin to deal with it. But right now, everybody's in denial, and anybody who brings it up is called all kinds of nasty names and is attempted to be ostracized from their society.
Well, because they don't want people waking up to this. And I mean, let's face it, a lot of this recognition here is, of course, the recognition of what's happening in the world. But the foreign policy that's been run by Zog in most Western countries is, of course, causing displacement in itself. But you have another aspect to this, and it wouldn't be happening without the people who are advocating the type of mass immigration that we see. We have, you know, about Barbara Spector, for example, right? Who
she's become the poster girl for our campaign, hasn't
yes.
she?
Oh, sure, certainly. Thank you for speaking out, you know. All right.
Well, what they say is they always overplay their hand, don't they? They always overplay their hand. They become actions and they reveal the plan, you know. So, yes, Spector gives us our ammunition, you know.
Yeah, and for those who don't know, go to YouTube, type in Barbara Spector, and look at that clip. And she's sitting in Sweden and actively is working to make Europe multicultural. That's her task, and she says that Jews are going to be behind it. You can take that for whatever it is. You can investigate that. I don't know why she talks like that. That's her words.
Has anybody ever pulled her up on it? Because it's such an iconic piece now, you know? It's just shared everywhere, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is.
It really is. I mean, she must be in some trouble in the local synagogue.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we got to do try to get a contact with her in some way and get an interview and see if she would like to expound on those theories and what she means by that. And also, of course, how she can include everybody in that, because there are certainly other people that have been speaking out. We had another gentleman from in Norway. I forget his name right now, but he's behind the Jewish organization in Oslo and behind the anti-racist movement up there. And he's talking about how racist Norwegians are and that they have a big task ahead of them of bringing what he calls minorities, which, again, isn't really minorities. Norwegians, people, are a minority in the world. There's only 4 million Norwegians in the world. They are a minority. But he says that we have to bring these minorities to Norway to try to fight their evil and wicked racism. We have Annette Kahn in Germany, very outspoken. There's an interview with her on RT. She's also Jewish. She's speaking about how it's so important to basically destroy the ethnic homogeneity of European culture or, you know, countries. And so my question is, why what is the problem with this? What is so bad with the Europeans? What is the issue at hand here? And how is this not recognized as an active warfare tactic of genocide, which would occur in any other case? Can you imagine if Europeans were sitting talking about having population replacement in Zimbabwe or Congo or, you know, Malaysia or anywhere else and saying, we have to bring in more Europeans. It's way too, you know, there's way too many Asians here. There's way too many Africans in this country, right?
We're in a deep trance. And the enemy is the master of propaganda. They don't even need an army. They just master propaganda. And over the last 70 years, they've bludgeoned us right across the West with this deeply, deeply pervasive propaganda that has created this white guilt amongst our people that we are now on a course of mass suicide, you know?
Yeah.
And even faced with the reality of the situation is that people are still compelled to follow this trance, this programming that is, you know, unfolding before our eyes. Some people have broke free from the programming. You know, some people are broke free, but they're not prepared to speak about it publicly, you know, and then there's still a huge mass of people that don't even know what's going on. They've got no idea at all, you know, and they're just walking into oblivion. You know, and that's the problem, is that, you know, they control the mass media to such a degree that they can create policy through media that is pervasive across the entire Western world. This is not just contained to a few countries. This is a policy right across the West, you know.
Yep.
It's quite incredible, really. It's actually quite incredible the way they're able to achieve it and pull it off. You know,
it is.
It's diabolical in the true sense of the word.
It definitely is. It's our job to wake people up to this and talk about it, because, you know, the elite does have plans for you, and they control, you know, the moral dialogue with, you know, through the entertainment media and the news media, and they show also, they do some of these tests, and I think you're even part of that, actually, Lawrence, where they throw a sheep to the wolves of sort and say, if you talk about any of these issues or whatever, I don't know how much it was detail of what you actually even talk about, but nonetheless, they show it as an example, they made an example out of you and say, If you touch upon anything like this, watch, this is what happens. But the cure to that is just, come on, people, just let's speak up, grow a pair, just get out there, talk about this. This is happening. Don't you realize if you don't address these issues, if you know about it, but if you don't talk about it, you're participatory in the genocide of the European people.
I recently saw Lana's St. George video, and it was just absolutely incredible. One of the most powerful videos in our arsenal. I just congratulate you and Lana upon creating it. It was just,
thank you. Yeah.
That breaks the spell.
Well, that's what we have to do. See, that's my point. We have to have more of that analyzing. Look at the TV shows. Look at the morality that's being exhibited here, and the absolutely hatred towards white people, and you know, just putting the, I mean, in their wildest dreams, there was even if we would go back to like the 20s or 30s or something, the early days of television, because I know some people have, and they try to argue that, oh, there was so much racism in TV, and maybe in the 40s and 50s, 60s, etc. But in their wildest dreams, what's being done today against white people in the media, was never anything that occurred in TV back in the early days of television, and it shows that how far it has gotten, where we don't speak up and say anything about it because we've been so programmed to not have an awareness of our own ethnicity, of our own racial background, and anyone can say anything they want about us, but we never say anything back, you know.
I think Kai Muros, is that his name?
Kai Muros, yeah.
Kai Muros, yeah. He's great. I mean, he says, you know, it's going to get a little bit worse before it gets better, but when we wake up, we will wake up rapidly, and there will be a huge change, and it will happen quickly. And I believe that. I believe it will get to the point where, you know, people just won't be able to deny it any longer, and they will see it as a threat to their survival. And survival instinct is the most powerful instinct we have, and it overrides everything else, including programming, you know?
Yeah.
So I think we're approaching that point quickly now, especially with the work that you and Lana are doing. It's just out there, and it's giving everybody else the confidence to say, okay, well, this is what it is, and it's giving us a platform that the fascist Marxists won't give us. You know, so I think we're on the threshold of a tipping point. You know, I think when that tipping point occurs, I don't know what will happen. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen when the internet wakes up to the fact that people are trying to genocide us completely, totally.
Some really interesting things are going to happen. You take my word for it.
Viking spirit will awaken, you know.
Well, there you go. Exactly. It has to. That's just it. It's going to be drawn out. Now, let's see if there's anything else we should cover here, Lawrence, before we've gone on for coming up to 3 hours here. But it's been a very interesting discussion, and it's been a pleasure hearing about your, you know, journey through all these fields. It's been a pleasure to hear how you were ousted by these people, which shows their character and the very aspect of why they're afraid of having someone like you on coming to their forum and address some of these issues, because they're so so pertinent and so important in these times. But is there anything else that you want to mention, of something that's occurred or anything else? Basically, we want to hear about your websites, of course, and letting us know how people get in touch with you, if they can help you out in any way, if they can support you, what have you, you know. So please, the floor is yours.
Well, I've decided that I need a platform myself because I've been denied one. So I've set up a website at very early days. It's going to be a blog. I'm going to use it to express my ideas and the people who are with me, their ideas. I'm also going to start doing some podcasts, interviews. Maybe I could interview you and Lana.
Sure, yeah.
And also I'm going to do some videos and just try and create a media platform in which we can get our message across to at least provide some counter to the onslaught we face, you know, from the mainstream media. You know, you can get me on Twitter, Lawrence Eastman. You can get me on Facebook, Lawrence Eastman. And, you know, please show your support. Let's get involved together. Let's work out how we can defeat this. And we can only do it by joining together, you know, and becoming one. So thanks, everybody, for, you know, supporting me so far. And I've got a lot of support. You know, despite their attempts to destroy me, you know, it's only made me stronger.
Very well. Well, we're just kind of getting started here, too, so we're just in the early days. But, yeah, great stuff, Lawrence. The website here again, then, thepeopleversusthebanks.co.uk, and you guys have some links from there as well to Lawrence, you know, Facebook and Twitter and the YouTube channel as well. And do check out that video, too, by the way. Excellent stuff on how to break down the banks, you know, and there's so much important information there. But Lawrence, please keep up the good work, and of course we'd love to have you back. Please keep us posted on, you know, what happens here ahead, and just you know, keep fighting the good fight, and we'll get the word out, and we'll start our journey towards an interesting goal, a destination here, you know.
Great, Henrik, it's been a real honor. Thanks so much for having me on the show. I look forward to speaking to you again.
All right, folks, that concludes our program for today. Thank you for listening. And by the way, don't forget to share your comments on redicemembers.com if you're a member. If you're not a member, sign up and support an independent radio program. You also get full access to our archives, all the second hours of our programs that we make available for our members as well. Well, stay tuned for more. The next 2 days, we have upcoming Carlos Morales, an ex-Child Protective Services agent, speaking out about the corruption from within the agency. And then we have Anthony Michels from Holland on more on the details on usury and the flaws of the monetary system. We also have Kerry Bolton, and then we have a return visit from Jesse Ventura as well ahead. In the meantime, we say take care, stay warm and cool, and all those other temperate terms that we love to use. And we will speak more soon. Have a good day.